Hello and welcome to episode 334 of Muse on Minis.
Musing and amusing.
This is John and I play Protector Domenoth.
This is Keith and I play Krix.
Brent and I'm still on sick.
This is Seabass and I don't know what I play right now.
Okay. It's okay to have these moments of crisis. I've been there.
Well, welcome to another episode, guys. We had a lot of fun War Machine topics to talk about tonight. Like, Keith and I went to the Renegade Open, so we have some games to talk about. But first, I heard there was some Troll Dojo.
Oh, yeah, we can open with Troll Dojo. So, we know from experience that the greatest dojo happens in long car trips, yes? Yes, this is an accepted fact of War Machine.
I mean, that's how Meat Mountain got started, right?
Yes, thank you for reminding us.
That's how a lot of abominations got started in the meta.
Chad was like, I'm building this list with these warders in this Crystal 2. I think they'll be hard to kill. And there was that fateful moment. Like, we were only 30 minutes away from TempleCon, and I could have just kept my mouth shut. But instead, I was like, I'd probably drop that Pyre Troll and add another unit of warders. And thus, Meat Mountain.
Except Chad built it with Jarl at first.
Oh, yeah. Very first Meat Mountain was Jarl. That's right.
Yep.
He was building a Jarl list.
Yeah, it's because the Tactical Supremacy could get the warders up the table quicker, right? Wasn't that?
No, he had Quicken. He had Quicken.
Quicken. I'm sorry. Yep. Yeah.
Field faster.
And then his feet.
I mean, it worked.
Yeah. No.
He didn't lose a game with it. That team tournament was a 6-round team tournament.
It was pretty gross. And then I realized I couldn't beat it. And then I realized I hated. What's that?
Go ahead. You can finish.
I said. Then I realized I hated both Keith and Chad.
So in a similar vein, I was on this car trip and it was. Because a couple of our troll players, and this confuses me, a couple of our local troll players have become discouraged, not wanting to play their trolls, even just after the CID updates came out, and I was confused. One of the reasons cited is the power of Grimkin, and another of the reasons cited is the introduction now of the Trollkin, of the Express team. One of our troll players gets particularly unhappy when Trollkin models come out for other factions that are good.
Fair.
The fact that the Trollkin that the Express team is a Trollkin is like a double whammy for him. But so they've been getting discouraged, and I was having this conversation with Quimby as we were driving up to the Renegade Open, which is like a 4.5 hour drive, 4.5-5 hour drive for us. And I was like, I gotta believe there's great lists and trolls right now. And like, we know about Power of Cold Grima in a Power of Dunia list. We know about the efficacy of Madrak 1 with his champion kit, and we know about that, and I suspect that all three Doom Shapers are viable. I have strong suspicions that some of the other casters are viable. I was actually, this started me looking at Gristle 2 and being like, what can I do with Gristle 2 these days? And I put some Fenblades in and I put some other stuff and I was like, this list looks pretty good. And then I was like, hold on a sec. Isn't Madrak 1 unfortunately now just purely better than Gristle 1? Like the only point of comparison between the two, because she has deflection, which is +2 defense against guns. Madrak has +2 defense against and no knockdown. +2 defense against everything and no knockdown on his chosen ground spell.
Even ground, yeah.
Even ground, whatever. The ground spell he has. And I was like, yeah, that's a very bad comparison for Gristle. Her gun is a bit better than his, but his is still quite effective. Like, he'll knock down 2 infantry a turn pretty easily. Gristle might get 3 or 4 with her shots, or sometimes 5 or 6. But her gun's a bit better. But it's like dash compared to like guided hand. Yeah, like guided hand probably does more for you they're different. So they're just different. And then feats, like Gristle's feat is unyielding and reposition 3, and Madrak's is you can't charge me and heal a bunch of stuff. They're both, and I rate his survivability feat a little higher. Anyway, I just decided to port my list over to Madrak and do a little bit more futzing with to see what I got to, and I started to really think about Fenblades and their value and what they can provide for him, and so I wanted to get maximum Fenblade. It starts with 20 Fenblades with their UAs. And they don't have set defense anymore. It's fine, because set defense was kind of a scornergistic bonus for them insofar as with their speed 6, reach, and no quarter mini feats, the number of times that they weren't hitting the Alpha Strike was low enough that set defense wasn't helping them. Usually, your opponent had the ability to walk and attack Fenblades because the Fenblades had already charged. They do still have Vengeance. And I think for the first time in the game, the hard rule is actually relevant.
Yes, it is.
Quite a bit of cavalry out there and both the Kador and Trollkin battle engines are becoming popular, and they're all about impact attacks. Being hard against those is yet another way that Trolls holds the line. They hold their presence on the board. They don't lose ground easily. And this list is going to be very much about taking ground, holding ground, and keeping your opponent out of zones. Primarily a 2017. Fenblades do have Vengeance, which also makes them, when you can't reliably kill very many of them, which is what Madrek is all about, Vengeance value way up. And Tactician makes that even better, because Madrek can allow the Fenblades to intermingle without any negative effects. In fact, there are many positive effects to them intermingling. It makes playing around Vengeance nearly impossible. It allows them to clear for each other so that one unit might end up hanging back, allowing the other unit to get very effective charges and jam. And that's pretty much it. But those are two noticeable benefits. So that's the core of the list, is the 22 Fenbolt, 24. The two of them don't have one. And then I think Madrek is too good with champions not to take one unit and not to take Scaldi. But I don't subscribe to attaching sorcerers for more health. Like, the main goal of this list, most of the time, will probably be feeding to stop charges, not to fully heal champions. That's fine, but I think that version of the list offers your opponent too much ability to play around it. You're just asking a fairly basic question rather than giving yourself a lot of options. And that's okay for rounds one and two, but then there's four more rounds. So we do have Trollkins and Scaldi in the list. That forms the core of your offense. Now, in order to deliver that, you have Madrax, Even Ground, and in our solo spots, we're taking two Stonescribe Chroniclers. Now, these are mainly for the Fenblades, although later in the game, they'll start to work with the champion. In the early game, their job is going to be to conceal the Fenblades against gunfire, making them defense 16 against the vast majority of guns. Defense 16, armor 16, tough no knockdown. It's a stat line which is not easy to shoot in, and then triggering Vengeance comes very bad for you. So shooting at the Fenblades is a decision that doesn't have a lot of positive outcomes for most gun lines, or for most combined arms list. Some of the gun lines will be able to tear you down. And that's why our other list is probably 6 Cloud Colgrimma with 4 Heavy. And those Stonescribe Conquerors have two other uses. One is that they give you a Troll Gang, is what we call it, which is ganging with Trollkin beasts. Troll Gang, yeah. And so that can get champions into hit absurdly hard range.
Can also get
blades into hitting at PS 15, which is very respectable. That hits hard enough to crack most things.
Yeah. I mean, you average 26 on the charge, right? So even like a worst case, you're hitting something that's armor 23, like a Devastator. Chipping in 3 damage per Fenblade adds up fast. It's certainly good
enough.
Totally
fine. If you can get charge of the trolls to go at the Fenblades, they become armor crackers, basically whatever you want. I did not put, there was no room, / I did not choose to put a Fellcaller in this list. Between the Runebearer being able to cast Guided Hand and Madrek being able to cast Guided Hand, I'm not worried about being mat 6, but just don't think a Fellcaller is important enough compared to what the Stonescribe Chroniclers do. The Chronicler's third effect is probably one of my favorite interactions with this list. When you've got your intermixed 2 units of Fenblades jamming them up, defense 14, they're no knockdown tough, they have Vengeance, everything about them makes you not want to kill them, but you have to kill them to get past them into scenarios, then put Hero's Tragedy on them. And anything that kills one falls over. Knocking things down just makes your Vengeance attacks so much better because they auto-hit. So that's the one time in the game that even if I had a Fellcaller, the Fellcaller would not. I can't get Guided Hand on them for Vengeance attacks. So it's like knocking things down with Hero's Tragedy, A, reduces your opponent's efficacy on their own turn, as well as increases your efficacy on your turn with their Vengeance attacks. And it prevents them from, like, Warcaster to get work done if they don't want to be knocked down in front of a bunch of Fenblades. It's glorious and annoying. So those Fenblades really are the backbone of the list. They're hard to shoot on the way in, / sometimes it's detrimental to be shooting at them. They jam you up and out of scenarios. They protect themselves from cavalry. And then their retaliations are strong. Finish out the list. We need a battle group yet. Madrek has 29 War Beast points. The list got tight, so I only spent exactly his battle group points. The Impaler for the necessary snipe animus for him. Then 2 Trollkin Bouncers. Just be sturdy beasts with reach to enable charge of the trolls. And the shield guards for the champions to make sure that you can deliver them. Because sometimes people might be able to shoot past the fen blades into the champions and ding you up, especially if they're playing a heavier armor list where you're going to need those chains. So having a couple shield guards is value.
It's also good for Madrak.
Absolutely.
Not that he's
really hard to kill, nearly impossible to kill with two.
Correct. And he's going to be front and center. Not going to lie, I think that list will be really, really good in 2017. Because the problem that...
Go ahead.
I was going to say, the problem with most of the Madrak lists I see now is they're a little slow to get going.
This will not be that.
Yeah.
No, it's not.
To finish it out, we've got, of course, I mentioned him before, a Rune Bearer on Madrak as one of our free solos. Scaldi is... What did I use for free? Rune Bearer...
The two Fenblade officers,
sure. Or Scaldi, whichever. They're all five. Yep. Yeah. To fill out the list, there's a minimum Creel Stone with the Elder. I didn't think a maximum was necessary. Most of the time, you're going to be able to put that stone pretty far forward, just like behind the champion brick, and it's going to be totally fine. And cover the majority of the Fenblades. If you need to cover all the Fenblades, you can scrunch them up a little bit more. There's no real penalty for scrunching them up because of tactician, unless you're fighting a lot of like high explosive damage, but that's pretty rare. Not like they're going to get lit on fire.
Do you want some free advice? Is the list done or no?
Not quite.
Okay.
Then we were just left with and then I put Eilish in because I think he was very important for
me. Damn it!
Eilish is in the list because Rebuke is becoming. I'm seeing more Rebuke out there, and I don't want Fenblades to get rebuked. Also, Puppet Master for Madrak is so crucial because it makes the Blood Boon plan something that you can plan on instead of gamble. I'm not willing to snipe myself and boost a hit if there's a decent chance it fails and I have to spend my remaining 3 Fury and go empty to cast Even Ground. I would much rather spend 1 or just spend the 3 and camp 2. But with Eilish in the list, then I've got a reroll on my hit roll and a reroll on my ricochet hit roll. Or on a damage roll, it just makes it super likely for that Blood Boon to go off and get you that get you value and Even Ground. And then that left me with 2 points in the list, which I was very happy about because that gives me a unit of Swamp Gobbers, which are and conceal the champions on the approach. I haven't actually looked at it to see if I can fit all 6 champions in the cloud with the Swamp Gobbers, but I think I can.
If you just get the front rank, right?
Yeah, you don't need them all. So that the whole unit is so that all your units are concealed, and it gives you a 2-man unit to score zones without having to contort your list by like running all the chains. Unpleasant like that. The Swamp Gobbers is a nice tech choice. So the list has 3, make that 4 solos for scoring flags, 4 units for scoring zones, 5 units, 4 units, 5, 3 beasts for scoring squares, and Madrak if he needs to score whatever.
Yep.
This is the first. After writing this list, I was like, I see nothing that I want in here that I don't have. I think it's going to be an enormous problem if it gets spread around. So I was like, I'm not going to talk about that. That was my
conclusion. Yeah, and then you demerited it.
I got excited. I might play this at the shop.
Yeah.
So I can't say Keith gave me this list. Put it on the table versus Irusk to. In Winter Guard Command, and that game was very frustrating for my opponent. He kind of had this plan to where he kind of did the same thing I think a lot of players do when they have, like, double rocket core. They kind of want to, like, stand back, engage threat ranges, and see if they can try and get you to commit a little bit extra to get in there, and then they can try and start peeling you off, and then eventually they're going to move forward. What he ended up doing in order to not lose on scenario is he ends up running his jacks forward after they get their advance moves. And then because of the way terrain works out, I'm able to get the fen blades like really far forward. I have them interspersed with each other, but I'm just taking up a massive footprint on the table. So it comes back around. I go into him. He has a battle engine. He moves his battle engine in reserve. I go into him. I end up running to engage with pretty much both units. I got like just very few charges off. But on my approach, I was def 16, and because of the way terrain was set up, he didn't really have that many rifle core that he could aim with. So he ends up having to move because of terrain and things to be able to get shots. So they're def 16, he's rat 5. So if you do that math, like, it's really bad. He needs 11, so he has to change it. So he Joes one. He Joes a unit. So now that unit just needs nines, right? And then, like, he has to do, like, two-man CRAs to hit the break-even point. So two-man CRAs make them POW 12s. And he needs, so he needs sevens to hit, and he needs fives to actually break armor. And then I have tough on top of that, and I'm no knockdown. Like, he couldn't get anywhere near the amount of work done that he needed to get done. And so at that point, I go into him. I jam him up really hard. I was able to get, like, three Fen Blades on his battle engine. And he was like, okay, well, I got this plan. And he starts working at it. And he's looking at the table. And he's like, well, I can't trample my way out of this. And then he, like, he looks at my tablet again, and he's reading the Fen Blades. And he's like, I can't slam my way out of this. Well, this is bull crap. And then he's like, okay, I got an idea. I'm just going to use the battle engine. I'm just going to carve a path. And then I kind of looked at him, and I'm like, you need to read Fen Blades again. And he's like, wait a minute. And then he reads them, and he's like, they're hard. Wait, impact attacks. Wait, it's a battle engine. It's not cavalry. And then he flips over, and he's like, oh, crap, it's cavalry. Excuse me. So, excuse me. So he essentially has this table-flipping moment where he's like, oh, God, why? And he ended up killing, like, I don't know, about six Fen Blades. I made some tough checks. I made, like, a couple more tough checks than I probably should have. But at that point, like, I score heavily on his two. And then at that point, the game's over. So it's very good. This list is real. If you're a troll player, you probably should try it.
Yeah, I'm ashamed of mine. Really.
Don't be ashamed of yourself. This is the second amazing troll gift you have given the Creels. And we love you for it.
Whoa. The first one was mostly Chad's fault. I just chipped in at the end. It was 90% Chad's fault. Look, and all the work that happened to Meat Mountain subsequently was all Chad's.
No, I'm not taking away credit from Chad.
No, but blame. Blame Scott, not credit. Meat Mountain is what ruined Mark II. Many people said so.
So I've got a thought after listening to all that. Like, I'm trying to get ahead of the meta. And I think I have a thought on a caster in the Protectorate stable that I think is going to be good in the future meta, because I'm going to have to replace Testament. And I think people that are slow to replace Testament, as soon as Scourge comes out with RFP, then, like, the Testament list is no longer playable in the meta. Which
I rate it as fairly unlikely that we see that Theme Force come out with that benefit.
Really?
Fairly unlikely. I mean, that was the most... There was... Functionally, how it was phrased in CID was that there was an impromptu dev talk done about that Theme Force benefit. I don't think they've ever done a dev talk about something and not changed.
Interesting.
I can't say with any certainty what it might be, but I am, like, at least 80% confident that RFP is not what it will be.
Well, as long as
we advance move.
Yeah. No, that would be a disaster. That cannot happen.
Souls also said in the previous weeks that among the things they are not considering is any threat range increase on the list or additional terrain mitigation for the list. So it won't be advanced move, advanced deploy, apparition.
So he said that, but then they gave them full Pathfinder instead of Relentless Charge the same week.
Not as a Theme Force bonus.
Okay.
Yeah, because they took away Pathfinder as a Theme Force bonus, they compensated by slightly increasing the benefit of the Pathfinder prayer on the Raiders.
Interesting. So anyway, I think I've been thinking about Haley 3 a lot, Keith, and I think I found my answer. And I wanted to talk it through with you. What's that?
Is it Resnik 2?
Nope. I've not built the list yet, but I have an idea. So I want to play Sev 1.
Okay.
I want to play a Blessing of Vengeance. I want to put Defender's Ward on it. I want to put Ashen Veil on it. I want to run it into the Cloud Wall. I want to arc three Ashes to Ashes to make sure that I kill the guy that grants Tactician, Finn, and then as many Long Gunners as I can. Right? I think that's a great start.
Yeah, if you kill the Tactician guy, your chance of clocking the Haley player increases by like 30%.
Right? Not only that, but that then I also am going to move up 7 feet on that turn and try. I've got to get him in a safe spot, so it's going to take like two turns of planning, right? But my feet has to go deep enough where you can't easily repudiate and get rid of Defender's Ward, and you can't easily cast.
You just have to acquire him before he goes in, right?
Yes. Yes, I'll acquire the Jack before he goes in, but I want Sev's feet to cover you deep enough to where you can't get repudiate to take Defender's Ward off the Jack, and then you can't hope. What's that?
Oh, you're gonna no-shoot the Jack instead of no-spell the Jack?
Yes, because if I get Sev's feet deep enough, you won't be able to force hammer. Because Haley past will be too far forward. I think I can get her to where she just has no options, right? Other than to maybe go in and try and beat it up. But that's not going to...
You might be okay just no spelling the Jack, honestly.
Maybe.
Because, like, the long gunners, which are the greatest threat to him, are going to get magic attacks from Ayana anyway.
Well, I can also aim those ashes to ashes to maybe take out Ayana if I play that plan. Like, it just depends on how the board lays out. You have a lot of options, but...
You're
like,
asking a lot of those ashes.
Not much. They're power 13.
No, the hitting.
They're not...
And the targeting.
Well, the targeting's usually not that bad, because there's always something I can hit to get my bounce to where I want to get, right?
It's tricky behind the cloud wall because after the reposition, the trenches clump up so much that they often inadvertently block line of sight.
Yeah, but I can hit, you know, whatever. I can hit the first one to clear out the trenches I need to get line of sight on the next two. You know, whatever. Well,
that's possible.
I think I can figure it out. Anyway, I think it's a pretty good plan for Haley 3. I at least think it gives me a game. And then Seb's feed is really good into that. Because if they can't cast anything, and then... especially if I get it to where you can't cast Flux. So on my follow-up turn...
You can push Severius far enough forward to push Flux, or to push so that, like, Prime would have to killbox herself to cast Flux.
Yep.
That would be it. I don't know. I haven't done any math on how far up the board Severius would have to be, but that would be great.
Yep. Well, I mean, he's fairly safe because there's no Force Hammer, right? So I just have to block line of sight with a couple lights or something. Like, I think I can make him I think I can build him a bunker where he's fairly safe doing it because his feet gives him the afforded protection that he needs from, like, his Jack getting force hammered over him and then him getting assassinated.
His feet stops arcing as well as spellcasting?
It does.
Yeah, okay, then you're safe.
Yep.
I was going to say, I think a lot of Haley 3 players are playing an arc node, and I'm considering giving that advice to more because I was feeling its lack a little bit in the few games I played, but as long as his feet stopped arcing, yeah, it shuts all that down.
Yep. And so, but then I was thinking about it, and I'm like, well, actually, his feet plays really well in the meta right now. Madrak one was one I thought of, because you shrink his, like, no knockdown bubble to 6 inches, and his +2 defense to 6 inches, and you kill a bunch of those Fenblades. You can do things like...
8 inches, gonna have the...
Oh, yeah, fair enough. But still, that's a lot.
Yeah, for sure.
And then he also, you can also sometimes, like, catch him where he won't be able to cast even ground the next turn because he won't be able to cast spells. Because, you know, Sev's feet is 16 inches deep, so it's pretty hard. You just got to make sure I'm going to make sure I have a couple of shield guards to make sure he doesn't randomly get assassinated because I'm going to be putting him forward. But I'm gaining more
confidence. You're thinking Faithful Masses?
I'm thinking Faithful Masses because then the other thing because remember we built that Fiora 3 list? And I was like, man, these Idrians kill the world with Insight. And I'm like, Aya Menoth is half of Insight and a lot safer to apply.
Yeah, that's a good
one. Right? And Sev's feed is way more live, and I get to pick up Defender's Ward and Vision and, you know, random other things. Yes. What's that?
Fiora 3 is the project that we want to love but just can't quite make happen.
I know, right? I want to love that list. But I'm just like, well, I think I can build this Sev list to be a real problem child. And I just love the idea of this Blessing of Vengeance being in the middle of that Haley army, being Def 16, Armor 21, potentially with Enliven. Like, I haven't built the list yet. I'm just thinking about all the things I can do to just be a complete and total jerk. And it's going to be, like, right in the middle of their army, and so they're going to want to deal with it because they're not going to want to have three more Ashes to Ashes thrown into them because that list doesn't handle that very well.
Sounds like what you're doing is converting your... I'll say questionable. You know, I mean, we didn't really get the chance to further test it, but it sounds like you're just trying to transport your WTC list, John. And I think I'm not sure that was successful enough to really keep working with. You might want to make some serious alterations.
Number one, that was Sev 2. Number two, that was not my list. Number three, the list I'm talking about has one stupid arc node. It has the Blessing of Vengeance. That's it.
You're not putting in backup arc nodes so you can repeat the run and ashes plan?
No.
Oh, all right.
No. The other...
That's probably good, because I think you successfully proved to yourself that was not a good plan.
I didn't have to prove it to myself. I knew it wasn't a good plan. But that...
Well, then why did you make that list?
I didn't make that list! You know I didn't make... Go ahead, Brian.
Did he really prove it to himself, or did he prove it to the entire world?
Yeah.
The entire International War Machine.
The other thing I was thinking about, Keith, and you know how, like, Danny One likes to run up on you, right? Mm-hmm. Like, the threat of Sev's feet actually pushes her back. I think, because she does not want to be feated on preemptively before she wants to feat.
That's true. Just trying to think from a Denegra perspective, especially if you go first. I mean, if you go first, she's already going to get... If you go first, she definitely wants to feed on two. If she goes first, she's pretty okay feeding on two or three.
Yep. But I can at least prevent her from feeding on for a turn or accepting a shitty feat, right? Either way, I'm happy. Also, shutting her down casting spells for a turn is not bad either. So, I don't know. I think Sev1 is going to play really well into the meta. Also, Ash the Dashes is just great against Satixis Raiders. Like, it's a great way to knock some of them down.
Absolutely.
So that's where my current thought is. I'm like, maybe I need to get Sev1 into my pair, build the list for a few specific matchups. I think it'll be pretty good, but, you know, I don't know. If the meta goes where I think. And then his feat also does other weird things, so... Like, say I feel like it's time for Testament to go out of my pair, but I play into the Testament matchup, feeding to knock Testament's control range down to 8 and just killing everything around so he gets no souls for a turn that's now outside of his control range is also, like, going to be pretty good. And Ashes to Ashes bounces don't trigger souls, so I can use the Ashes to Ashes, like, to get the stuff that's in his control range. I actually think that... he'll have good game into, well, the other list I love to play. But I don't know. That was just my thought. Do you think my plan into Haley 3 is well-conceived?
It's hard to say. That list, it's like, I found it difficult to theorycraft into Haley 3 because the experience on the table is always ends up being different than I think.
Yeah.
I have been working on some Haley 3 theories as a Crix player, and none of it is easy. Like, there's just no... There's no one thing that's the answer. It's like, I can take soon with the new releases. I'll be able to take a Kraken and make it see through clouds. But that doesn't fix the problem. It just makes them dig in instead. But you have to be able to, like, break up the cloud wall and then still be able to deal with the army at its face.
Yep.
So it's like, ugh. Ugh.
I mean, even in my mythical plan, right, if I can't get the solos I want to get... If I just kill 6 or 7 long gunners, that takes a lot of the teeth out of that list.
It certainly helps.
Yeah.
You get 6 or 7 long gunners, I think you're just giving Grandma Haley something to do over the next 2 turns.
Well, she probably won't be able to do it on the turn I feet, right?
Doesn't Ashes RFP?
No.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But yeah, I think it is a functional, I mean, it's a functional set of abilities that work that will work against Haley.
Yes.
It's a question of if it can be combined to a victory.
Right. I think it at least gives me a shot.
Yeah. I mean, having a potential route to killing Hitch, I think, is a great start.
Yes. I would agree with that. Like, I considered putting that module in the Flame Guard theme, and then at the same time running and jamming with TFG, because Defenders Warded TFG are actually pretty tough for you to kill the turn before, because they can be shield-walled, Iron Zealed, Defenders Warded TFG. Next turn, you know, I can just run the TFG and jam a bunch of stuff, run the Blessing of Vengeance in, get rid of Hitch, make it really hard on you then. Like, then the game gets really hard for you, I think, potentially, along with Sev's feet.
Yeah. Do you feel you're playing list chicken too much?
No. I don't necessarily believe that. I think...
Well, there's no clear consensus at this point what gets paired with Haley.
Right.
So it's hard to know if you're playing list chicken.
I think because I'm not talking about putting... Like, the only thing I've talked about putting in this Sev1 list, I'll have to tail, is the Blessing of Vengeance, Arrak, and a Hierophant. Like, that's what's required for my plan. Oh, and potentially the guy that grants Ashen Veil. I don't know that he's necessary, though. But I'm not committing a lot of points to my game plan, right? And those points all play into a lot of other games just fine. So I can build the list more skewed to playing the other Signar pairs. So, like, if I know this Sev list has game into Haley 3, then I can design the rest of the list to play into, like, Siege and Emo 3, blah, blah, blah. You know, those double Stormstrider lists, for example. I actually think Sevy has the tools to just take those Stormstriders off the table if he wants, just through standard... What's that?
I don't think the Reclaimer is going to get value for you in that list. I think the most likely result after Blessing runs in to a cloud somewhere is that he gets headbutted by a Grenadier and then executed by... French Busters.
What do they do for damage?
French Busters?
Yeah.
Pow 14 Weapon Master followed by a Pow 12 Weapon Master attack.
Right. Remember, yeah. That'll be pretty good, I guess. I mean, I'll be armor 21 with a repulsor shield.
Assuming you get to keep.
Right. Yeah. Like,
if you get headbutted by a grenadier, whatever remaining long gunners will be able to aim and shoot you and point at the shield column.
Potentially, yeah. Yep.
I would never, as someone who's played Haley, I would never make a plan about running something at her and having it live.
Right. Although,
maybe circumstances permit, like maybe there's a great piece of terrain that lets you tow into a cloud and also be in a defensible position. Maybe the jacks are slightly out of position, but it's just not something you can plan for.
Maybe I run an engage everything with TFG. Like, I think that's a pretty good plan.
That's also pretty questionable.
What's that?
That results in the ghost walk away and kill everything with long gunners situation.
Well, I mean, it doesn't result in the Blessing of Vengeance getting killed, though.
It might also result.
Maybe. We'll have to play it.
Ghost walk, trenchers walk through the TFG. One of them engages the Blessing. Long gunners murder TFG, and the leftover stuff kills. Is a possibility. But this is all, like, very ephemeral dojo. I'm just saying I wouldn't put a reclaimer list or go out of your way to put.
Right. I mean, I might just build the list, like, standard protectorate gunline with the Blessing of Vengeance, and then... I don't know exactly what theme force I'll use, but maybe a unit or two for contesting purposes that's fairly sturdy, especially one that's...
Yeah, I also think that Protectorate Jack lines are not inherently bad against Haley 3, just because there is a limit to the number of magical attacks she can make. Like, yes, magical long gunners can do a significant amount of damage to heavies, but not just an insurmountable amount, especially if
also,
you're like, contesting with vigilance.
Yeah, even a couple of shield guards really split that up a lot, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Rule out creators.
Yep, I just hate that theme list. I don't think it plays well into scenario, so I have to think pretty hard on how I make that list play in scenario in a way that you don't that I like. But I think there's anyway. That's where my mind is at right now in the meta, just trying to stay ahead of it a little bit.
I think it's a decent start.
Yeah, there's just a lot you can do, and I mean, you know, I can always just do the old, like I said, the old fashioned, you know, Sev gun line where I'm just like. All right, we can play a game, but I'm going to take a Storm Strider off every turn with range shots, and there's nothing that those Signar lists can do about it. Like, they'll just die.
My initial thought about it, about how to do it, how to beat it as Crix, revolves around a lot of the new releases. It's like a Scar 2 list where I use the Smog Belcher Smoke Wall as well as a Kraken with the Shard Dirge Seers, so it's an Eyeless Sighted Kraken. To force them out of Cloud Wall into digging in, and then I do get a Cloud Wall, and so I can eventually make them fight me in melee instead of beating me up at range.
Kind of. You can make a Cloud Wall, but it doesn't protect the Kraken, so they always have something to shoot at until it dies.
It's an armor 21 Kraken I get to pick column on.
Yeah, not the worst.
Hopefully I can keep it alive until we get to it, make it to engagement. Like, I can keep it far enough away from the long gunners that they can't double tap at it easily.
Yeah.
Because if the long gunners move up into double tap range, then they are well within get blown up by Kraken.
Yep.
Oh, the first time they move up, they have to pop mini.
Yep,
feet.
They pop dig in, and then I have to survive that turn. I have to have a plan for the following. So I'm in the same boat, right? Like, I have some tools that help for the matchup, but no clear solutions.
I don't think there's any way to solve for Haley 3. Like, you're in for a slog no matter what you do. You just have to have tools to be able to play the game.
Yep. So that actually was kind of my point. Like, I don't know that there's necessarily anybody who has, like, a slam dunk matchup into Haley 3 because that Warcaster does so many different things. But if you have, like John said, if you have enough tools that are capable, then you may be able to put enough of them together, and it's going to be 100% player dependent, right? Like, I'm pretty confident on paper that Cole Grima probably has a fairly decent matchup into Haley 3. It's not favored, I don't think, but I don't think it's a bad matchup. But I think whether or not you win that matchup is going to be 100% on how well one player is playing versus the other. I don't think, because of all the different things that Haley 3 can do, I don't think you walk into her matchup favored. I just don't see how you would.
Well, I don't know.
I've played that list a number of times, and the only time that I felt like I wasn't advantaged, strictly speaking, was against Grimkin Old Witch. She so drastically reduced the efficacy of the long gunners throughout the game. And every Grimkin gun has eyeless sight.
There aren't too many Grimkin guns, right?
Has eyeless sight.
I suppose.
Yeah, it's like the Hollowmen, the Frightmare, and then any caster.
Yeah, a Hollowmen can't ever hit somebody in cover, right?
I mean, they see RA, so can.
I suppose. That doesn't seem like a quick way to victory, though.
Certainly not. It was a long game, and it came down to being very close at the end. I made a couple mistakes, and I was playing against Pat, so there was no wiggle room. But that was a game that I was like, if I played this more, I could definitely win this. That's kind of the Haley 3 thing. It's like the Haley 3 player, it's the whole game is kind of in the Haley 3 player's hands a lot of the time. You can do a number of smart things to make life hard on them, but they get every opportunity to play around you. That's how I felt from playing the Haley 3 side. And that is not easy. I'm not saying it's easy. I'm not saying like any good player can pick up Haley 3 and beat anyone. No. With infinite practice, any good player can pick up Haley 3 and probably beat anyone.
Yep.
But Haley players have every opportunity to play around things, and they also have every opportunity to trip on themselves and lose.
Yeah, I would say the Haley 3 probably has, it's in the discussion for the caster that has the most agency in any game that you play.
Yep.
For good and for bad.
Haley 2 and Haley 3, very similar in that regard.
Yes.
Haley 2 is more forgiving, honestly.
Which is crazy to say. yeah.
That was an impromptu little meta bender.
Yeah, well, it's something that's been on my mind, naturally, because you were a planer. So
yep.
I've just been sort of stewing it over in my head. And then I got my first game against Haley 3, which I always learn a ton in the first game that you play. My first game against Gravediggers, anyway. You kind of see how all the pieces work together, and you're like, all right, how do I deconstruct this? What can I do to, like, at least make them work for a victory? But I actually didn't hate my – because the scenario was live and because I had a building to hide behind – I didn't hate my Testament game into it. It felt pretty playable.
Yeah, you can put – that's one of the – it's kind of like when we used to talk about Lilith 2. In the dojo, functionally impossible to beat her. But on the table, there always felt like something you could do. And that's somewhat the case with Haley 3. Like, she is not fast on picking up her scenario pressure. It's somewhat inexorable, but you can certainly make it hard for her to get into scenario and stay live in scenario. That requires some specialized tools, like usually the ability to kill an aggro. But she doesn't take position on scenario very quickly. So scenario pressure is one of the ways in which you can give the Haley player some opportunities to lose. I would definitely say scenario pressure is a necessary element to playing against him.
Yeah, I was putting an incredible amount of pressure on Quimby, where I think I scored 3 in a turn because he didn't move up aggressively enough. Because he was trying to cloud wall. But I think, honestly, against the Testament list, if he had just dug in and got more ground, he probably would have ended up being in a better spot.
Yeah, against, like, the Rat 6 Errant Bows.
Yep.
I mean, they are blessed, which is annoying, but...
Yeah, but
dig
I mean...
in and force you to deal with the... take the shots needing 11s. No. Yeah,
11s. 11s, yep.
And forcing the Knight's Exemplar to just deal with the Death 15, which I also don't like, and just fighting it straight up is probably fine.
Yeah, it's probably better than Cloudwalling, actually. So
that also lets you position your Long Gunners a little bit more aggressively, because
yep.
You've got more room to deal with on the table. And, like, you've got to come in, and once you come in, the Long Gunners just go apeshit every turn.
Yeah, they go ham pretty hard, so that is true. Although, Quimby made the classic mistake of killing way too many Exemplar, and then letting me spell assassinate him.
Yep.
Which is actually fairly hard for Haley to stop.
I mean, if she's in cover with Flux up.
Yes, that stops it, obviously. Yeah. Also, he did make the questionable call of not casting Flux for a turn.
He misidentified how much of your army was blessed.
He did. We talked about it afterwards. I was like, you should have 100% cast Flux. I even told him that turn. I'm like, you didn't cast Flux? He goes, no, I didn't think I needed it. I'm like, you should have 100% cast Flux. That spell is always good. Or almost always.
Yeah, because it's just Errant Bows and Warjack melee attacks.
Flux. Yep. Yeah. That game is actually fairly hard, just in general.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah. I guess we could talk a little bit about our Renegade Open, right? We had a pretty good time there.
Yeah. So John and I and one of my locals, Jake Quimby, went to the Renegade Open as a three-man group. We played in the team tournament on Friday night, which was a relaxed three-man team tournament. The Renegade Open is a neat event. It reminds me, I told the event organizer, it reminds me of some of the older Daikons, or the older Adepticons with, like, the only back when there was only like 30 War Machine players showing up for those things, which is cool. I mean, it's got a more intimate feeling to it. You get to talk to people a little bit more, and the tournaments are shorter. Like, it was only the team tournament was only 3 rounds, but it was really fun to do on a Friday afternoon. We did win that. We can talk a little bit about our games. John, go ahead.
I had a couple of really memorable, fun games. My first round, I played against Osram with Caleb, and who's a really nice guy. I played him in Mark II with Lilith II, like maybe 6 years ago. And I remember that game, I was like grumpy, so I left a really bad impression with him. So I was like trying to be extra nice, because I was just like, I was such a not a nice person in that particular game. I'm not proud of it. Just, I don't know why I was grumpy, but I was playing Lilith II, and I just killed him on the top of two. And then, you know, but in this game, we were playing Osram, and, you know, Josh and I, we play that game a lot. And then what kind of happened, I think, you know, Caleb and I were just grinding back and forth. He's killing a ton of guys, because Osram does that, like, You get to kill a ton of Exemplar every turn. Like, that's how that game works. But he ended up clocking himself because he was just a little bit indecisive because he hadn't played against Testament before. And then I was bringing models back and contesting and, like, being really annoying in scenario. So he's trying to figure out ways to score scenario points. And I think he clocked on, like, maybe turn 4 against me. And then, you know, so I won that round. And then Keith won that round. And I think Jake, you did too. Keith, you want to talk about your matchup in that first round or...
My first round was against a Makeda 1 player. There was a lot of Masters of War this whole weekend. A lot of Scorn players, a lot of playing Masters of War. And I was talking to the organizer, who's kind of one of the leaders in the meta, and most of the Scorn players have been steered towards Makeda 1 over Makeda 2 because she's a little bit more forgiving to operate with her the 12-inch feet rather than the 10-inch stay death range, as well as the tendency for cats to overextend and do a little bit of work and then get killed. But so he was playing Makeda 1, and I was playing my Denegra 1 Scourge list. I was playing 2 units of Raiders, a min unit of Blood Witches with the UA, the 2 captains, a battle group, which was Double Death Ripper and Nightmare, and then a full unit of Nis Hunters, which I think the Nis Hunters are a good include at this point and will become... they will get phased out once Severa Black Tide comes out in favor of Satixis Gunslingers. But right now, the Nis. And the opening turns went fine. He came at me with the cats and did some damage and feeded. The mistake he made was not paying close enough attention to where the Blood Hag was and where her run would take her to. The Blood Hag was able to apply Entropic Force to all 5 cats and Radim. And I was able to kill them on his feet turn, which is the turn that I feeded on him. And then after that, there was really no coming back from that. So one small mistake leads to the classic Crix AO punch from a Denegra Alpha Strike.
Didn't you almost get assassinated in that game?
Not that game.
It wasn't that game?
Oh, wait, yeah. There was a possibility of death. After I did that, I had built a wall so that Molek Karn... wouldn't be able to, like, walk with Quicken and sidestep to my caster. I'd just put a bunch of stuff in a row around in front of Denegra. One of those things was Nightmare. The Gladiator got Rush and slammed Nightmare. And on a... I think it would have required exactly, like, a 5 roll, or exactly a 6 roll, so that Nightmare would have gone 8 inches and gone past Denegra. Because if it had gone 5 inches, he would have, like, displaced Denegra. I think it required an exact number, but... It was possible for the slam to push Nightmare over Denegra, knock her down, and allow the Gladiator to follow up and beat me. So it was frightening, but it didn't happen, thankfully.
Yeah.
The Nightmare came up short on the slam.
In my second round, in our second round, I guess I should say, I got to play against a Crix player. His name was Trevor. Sweet dude. He was playing Mort Nebra, and I'm trying to remember what his other list was. I was convinced he was going to drop his other list because I felt like Mort Nebra into Testament was not going to be good for him, and he dropped Mort Nebra anyway, just because of the number of Weapon Masters. His Mort Nebra list was interesting. It had, I think, three Stalkers, one or two Arknodes, Deathjack, a Kraken, and a Reaper. And let me tell you, the Reaper is scary with Mort Nebra, just because with the ability to trigger Overrun, and then move that Reaper, and then give it spectral steel, which gives it ghostly, allowing it to move wherever it wants. Like, it can, like, get a shot off on your caster from a lot of really crazy angles and drag you forward, which I was cognizant of. So I was trying to keep my arc or my devout next to my caster or within 3 inches to make sure that I had a shield guard for the Reaper shot in case he ever got a bead on Testament, just because it was scary. And I will say, this is not a complaint, but the tables in general were a little bit light on terrain there. Not terribly so, but some of the pieces were a little smaller or there weren't very many. So there was just more open terrain. Would you agree with that, Keith?
Yeah, there were definitely tables that were on terrain, and some of them ended up being shooting galleries.
Yeah. But anyway, we did a couple things wrong in this game, which caused me to take a game plan that maybe wasn't optimal, but I was sort of forced into it. One of the things that happened was he charged his Kraken into a bunch of Knights Exemplar errands, and he tuned it up, and then he did a sweep. And I was like, well, I think sweep is only 2 inches. And then he's like, no, it's 4 inches because it takes on the melee range of the weapon, and the weapon goes to 4 inches during an attack. And I'm like, I don't think that's true. I think a power attack sweep is always a 2-inch sweep. So we called the judge. The judge ruled in his favor, which was fine. I was like, oh, they must have changed that in Mark III. No big deal. But the sweep killed like 11 flipping errants or something, or like 9 errants. And he would have got like 5 less because I always play sort of deep, and I wasn't expecting that. And then they were all RFP'd. And so I was like, well, the Kraken has to die because I can't take, you know, 4-inch sweeps that are tuned up with that all RFP. Like, there's no – that is not a game I can win. Like, I was like, maybe this list is better against me than I thought. And because of the way that happened, because I was counting on being able to charge the Kraken with those other 5 errants if he came in, because I figured he wouldn't kill that many, I had to send my devout in on it, right, in order to make sure that it died. So I sent, like, all 3 of my jacks into it and then a few weapon masters because that side had gotten cleared off pretty good. Another really interesting interaction, in case you're wondering, is I tried to make it hard for him to trigger overrun because I mainly had errants and threat ranges. But if you put it on a stalker, it has grievous wounds, so then it 100% triggers overrun. So, pro tip. So anyway, I send my devout off, which gets him on his next turn to, like, come up with this crazy plan, because on my counterpunch, I killed all 3 stalkers, I killed the Kraken, and I dinged up the Reaper pretty good. And then I had a ton of stuff engaging the Reaper, so I felt pretty safe. But he triggered overrun by killing a Knight's Exemplar, which caused Deathjack to move forward like 6 inches. And then he put Ghostly on the Reaper, walked out of combat, got a shot on High Reclaimer, drug him forward, trampled Deathjack over a ton of stuff, got on High Reclaimer, and then was able to buy 2 attacks, which isn't very likely to kill me, but it did knock me down to 9 life. And so on my next turn, I don't know why, but we had used a proxy base for Deathjack, and he was nowhere in sight. And so I just looked over that proxy base. Now, mind you, this proxy base had just literally put 9 damage on my caster, but I'm not smart enough to remember that. So I look down, and I look, and I'm like, oh, cool. So if I just clear, you know, like this one arc node and score this flag in this zone that I'm going to score, I just win, right? Which is the I always look to close out games if I can, and that's like the least path to victory. So only one partial problem with my plan, and that is this armor 21 Deathjack, because he had used Derelis to spell slave Spectral Steel back on him before he did his trample.
Can't do that.
What's that?
Can't do that.
No, maybe Mort never cast it. I don't remember.
Okay.
Somehow it got back on him.
Okay. Spell Slave's an upkeep. Spectral Steel's an upkeep.
Oh, you can't do upkeeps?
Yep.
Oh, interesting. I don't remember exactly how it happened, but Deathjack was very much armor 21 and had not been touched yet. And so I was like, getting ready to win the game, right? And I'm like, oh crap, that's Deathjack. I'd already gone past my allocation step, right? I could have allocated 3 focus to 3 of my jacks and put 3 jacks on Mort Nebra, which 100% kills her. Well, it doesn't 100%. It's never 100%. But it's very likely to kill her. But I was like, this is an easier plan. So I left the focus on Testament because I just didn't think about it. So I play my turn. I'm like, what am I going to do? Well, I end up like doing all of these walking attacks because all my guys are like facing forward, all my Knights Exemplar in front of the Deathjack, and just taking my POW 13 Weapon Master attacks, doing 3 damage per swing. And I think I got like 6 or 7 on him, knocked him down most of the way down, and then I had Testament go in and finish him off, and then I killed the Reaper, and I killed the Bone Jack. So I killed literally every other model he had, but it forced me to charge units out of zones, so I scored no control points. So he's got only Morton Ebra. Testament's on 9, right? And I've managed to kill everything, but I had to really contort myself to do it because I didn't realize, you know, that was there. And he looks down at me and he's like, well, I guess I have to try and kill you. And I'm like, okay, well, I think it's going to be kind of hard because I don't think Morton Ebra can get line of sight to Testament because I'd done a good job, like, just gumming everything up. He's like, no, I definitely can't. And she's all tied up with, like, weapon masters. I charged her with a few weapon masters or whatever. Didn't kill her. And so I have this Jack that has his back arc to him because of the way I played the turn. He's like, all right, well, and he also managed to get one soul. So he had 8 focus. So he just starts doom spiraling this Jack in the back. And doom spiral, if you damage a Jack, does D3 damage to the Jack's controller. And I'm at 9 life, and he has 4 doom spirals coming at this thing. Because it's the back arc, and she's a 7, he needs 3s to hit. He needs, because it's in its back arc, it doesn't have a shield available to it, so it needs 6s to wound. And so he's like, oh, I hit. Oh, I do damage. Oh, take 3 damage. I'm like, well, that changes the math because it went from very unlikely to, okay, now it's kind of in the 50-50 range. Next one, I hit. Roll a 6 for damage. You take 3 more damage. Now I'm at 3 life, and he's got 2 more doom spirals, and I'm like, I think I'm going to die. And then he does the third one, and I think that one did 2 damage. Is that right, Keith? Yeah, the third one did 2 damage, left me at 1.
Yep.
And then he rolls the last one, he hits, and he misses his damage roll. I think he rolled a 4 or 5. And I was just like, oh, my God, I almost just died to Doom Spiral because I forgot that Death Jack was there. Like, I should have – there was ways for me to win that game. Had I remembered that I needed to kill Death Jack, like, I could have just played my turn completely different and reallocated resources. But since I didn't, I had to kind of contort and give him another shot at me. But, yeah, I almost died right there, which would have been pretty dumb. Like, I don't think Keith would have forgave me because Quimby lost that round too.
Yes. Yeah, I can recap Quimby's game for him. He got paired against Legion. I was like, oh, cool. Great matchup for Kane. He played Haley and lost.
Yeah. He played the Cloud Wall versus Legion instead of the thing that shoots 4 Legion's heavies off in a turn.
I mean, to be fair, Haley is also fine against Haley. Haley is fine against Legion for the most part. But
why wouldn't you take your windmill slam, though? Like, I don't know.
I don't know. I don't know, John. Can't answer that question. Just give the good advice, and then I have to go play my own game.
Speaking of,
I was playing against a Madrak. Storm of the North, and the guy I played against was very nice, but he said, he's like, yeah, I'm new back into the game and we don't really have a Krix player where we're at. And I was like, already starting to feel bad with my Denegra 1 Scourge list. He had I Crippling Grasped and Feated, and Death Hunters shot the unit of champions to death, and my ambush killed my ambushing suit Texas Raiders killed a unit of Fire Eaters and put the Blood Hag aura over top of the champions because I didn't want to deal with tough checks. My Raiders on the other side killed the other unit of Fire Eaters. He had a Glacier King, which moved up, and I'm not sure what happened, but it had to make a frenzy check, and then it frenzied the following turn. And then, because after I had feeded on him and the Mountain King, and the Glacier King frenzied, he didn't do very much that turn. Nightmare got into the Glacier King with Parasite and Ragman on the following turn and ate it. And then that was pretty much game. So his team fed him to the Lions.
Yeah, Gargantuans and Colossals are often a liability against Krix. It's not always true, but particularly Denegra, who can just like -7 it, or -5 it, I guess, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't get to it on the feet turn, but I got the -5 with Ragman on the following turn.
Fair enough.
My last game, in our third round, I was kind of scared. I dropped Denegra again, and this time it was into Mozar. And we have a Mozar player in our meta, so I am aware of his chicanery. And I was very afraid of his chicanery. It was an out-of-theme Mozar list, so you know they're trying to kill your caster when they're out of theme. Any out-of-theme list is 100% assassination and nothing else. Guaranteed. I'm looking at him like, he's trying to kill my caster. And sure enough, I got first turn, and I moved up semi-aggressively because the threat ranges on Blood Trackers kind of forced me back. And what he did was he ran Blood Trackers at me in kind of a very widespread pattern so that killing them all would have been super challenging. Put up pillar. He teleported a tree at me and crevassed to kill one Satixus Raider and one of the sea witches, which is definitely annoying. It was like the prayed unit of Satixus Raiders loses whipping winds. Not going to be great in the long game. I'm already worried about my caster dying. I'm already worried about, now that I've lost this Raider captain, I'm kind of worried about my long game. And then I ask everyone's favorite question, which is, how much is your caster camping? And the answer was zero. And there was just like one pillar of salt was blocking my way for the Arcanode to get in range. So I put five Satixus Raiders on the pillar of salt, which is not guaranteed because they have to roll a 12 to kill it. Because you can't gang against the structure. Luckily, I was able to roll that 12. I ran the Arcanode up and cast a Scourge, boost hit, boost damage, and one shot Mozar. I had four Nispos to follow up, and he had one Shield Guard. So it was likely to go even without it, but rolling the 15 on damage, just one hit with him. Assassination I went for because I was scared.
That guy was pretty good with Mozar, I think, at killing people. And he had beautiful
Anyone
stuff.
Anyone who plays Mozar is probably good at killing people with him.
Right.
Otherwise, you give up on Mozar.
Yeah. I have a funny story. I actually played Jeff later in the next day in a kind of a funny game. But so my third round, I got to play probably my favorite game of the weekend. I got to play against a gentleman named Nick who was playing Makeda 1 Cats. I think he only had one unit of cats, though. And he had Swordsman and Karax and Double Kriya and Moloch Karn and a Gladiator. I think that was most of his list.
And you rebuked his cats.
I did. pro tip, it's probably a good idea if you're planning on investing heavily in a unit, a 20-point melee unit, probably want to have Elish in the list so that you don't just lose to rebuke, which is kind of the summary of this game. He didn't have Elish. I played Harbinger because, interestingly enough, I play Harbinger because she really picks up all the matchups where Testament is bad, or not all of them, but she picks up a lot of them because a lot of people will bring this like melee-based RFP to deal with Testament, which is great against him. It's not great against Harby because it just isn't. Martyrdom stops all of that. So I'm basically playing the same list twice in that I invest two focus, which is D3 damage, as in two life, to keep a model in play. Just like I do with Testament, play a lot of the same scenario games. I have different pieces, obviously, but when I showed up to the tournament, I realized I had made a terrible, terrible mistake in that I didn't bring all my models. I didn't have a Kiki Monk. I was missing a Kiki Monk and a Hierophant. So I had to rebuild the Harbinger list, and the only way I could make the points work with the models that I had was adding a second unit of Idrians, which turned out to be great, by the way. But then I had to take the book out of the list to make the points work right. So I had playing Harbinger with no book, no Hierophant, which does not feel right in a lot of games. But it certainly made the list all business, which was nice. But yeah, Nick and I, we played our game, and it was kind of a long slog that I think I eventually won on scenario, or he clocked. I can't remember which it was. And he was a very pleasant opponent. He was awesome. He did a lot of smart stuff. But there's just, like, you can't do anything if your 20-point unit is rebuked. And so they can't leap. They can't do anything cool. And I was just, like, shooting and killing everything else because I have two units of Idrians and then, you know, these heavy jacks that are doing work and paladins that are doing crazy stuff. And, yeah, it was great for me. And then I also – he didn't really have a lot to threaten Harby. So if Harby is not threatened, she has a tendency to, like, go into, like, mega martyr mode, martyr down to two, heal for, like, eight, you know, martyr down to two. Like, it's just an insurmountable amount of attrition advantage when she's not threatened. Like, it's pretty tough. Oh, also, I think he decided he didn't like Kiki Monks because Def 20 Kiki Monks with Awe are very difficult to deal with, especially I think in that game I made two tough checks in a row on one. And I think probably the pivotal moment in that game was the only thing he could really apply pressure to Harbinger with was Moloch Karn, and he sort of gave Moloch away cheaply. And he's self-admitted that he doesn't get to play much. He didn't Fate Walker Moloch and get Moloch out of dodge, so it allowed me to kill Moloch, although I decided to make it interesting in that I was going to charge it with a Crusader, and then halfway through I blocked my charge lane, so I had to kill it with, like, a couple of paladins and random stuff, and then a cataclysm from Harby. That's how That's how I finished Moloch Karn off, because I was like, well, if Moloch Karn doesn't die, Harby 100% dies, because he's like 7 inches from her or something stupid. So
yeah, Vilmon was going to kill him, but Moloch Karn made Vilmon reroll, and he John rolled that 4 like a champ.
Yeah, that really sucked. He's like, well, he's dead anyway. I guess I'll make you re-roll it, and then I roll the 4. Like, Vilmon's a 9. He's a bad 9.
Wait, yeah, you roll the 3. You roll the 3. Moloch Karn's defenses. You only need 4s to hit.
Yep. Oh, that was rough. I was like, huh! Yeah. So we move Harby up aggressively. just nuke him.
Like, actually, the Crusader isn't... Because that Crusader, I don't think, was affected by Righteous Vengeance, Righteous Fury, whatever it's called.
Hand of Vengeance, but yes.
Hand of Vengeance, it was or wasn't?
I
don't think it was that round.
I don't think it was either.
So then you're dealing with like the Mat 6 into Moloch plan, which is like, and he had a couple Fury left for rerolls, so the Warjack might not have gotten there.
Well, I mean, but I was planning on boosting the charge attack, which would have been enough to put me over killing him pretty easy, right? So, because I still could have charged him with like a Paladin and some other stuff, but...
Yeah.
But yeah, Still scary. Like, I was like, well, I gotta roll. I think he was on like 4 boxes too, right? So the Cataclysm pretty trivially killed him, but I was still scared making that damage roll.
Yeah. Now you're in it, Harbinger.
Yeah, no, I put her right up there. I was just like, well, we're just gonna show off, I guess. Harby, get in there. But no, Harbinger is very good in SR 2017. Her feat tends to steal momentum on scenario. And even though it's only 10 inches, it's still far enough where things happen. And then the most powerful thing that she does on scenario, and I won a lot of games, was just a Kiki Monk contesting in Martyrdom range, especially if awe got applied to the thing. So it would be like Def 20, tough, steady, and martyrable. It was a really good way to sort of, anytime you can break that parity where, you know, you score your close zone, they score their close zone or their close flag, and you score your close flag or whatever. You know how you have that element where you each have it in sort of like just outside of your deployment that you get to score? Well, I was putting a Kiki Monk in those situations, and so my opponent would never get to score, and I would get to score, and then I would just blow the game open on scenario that way. It was very powerful. Anyway.
You're a bad person.
Why am I a bad person? I'm not the one playing Crix. I'm playing hard mode.
Martyring Kiki Monks? Nothing I do is as bad as martyring Kiki Monks.
That's... I don't know, Keith. I don't know. Feeding with Denegra feels worse than having 1 3-point solo survive.
Nope. Nothing is as bad as martyring Kiki Monks. Because the feeling of accomplishment you get when you finally hit and kill that guy and make it past the tough roll, so great that to take that away from someone is the height of cruelty.
It's not cruelty. You should have just expected it. That thing is never going to die unless you have like Grievous or Silence of Death. I had a Butcher 3 player. He's Tom. He was awesome. Great opponent. Really, really good player. He brought Butcher in to kill the Kiki Monk. But he didn't want to spend the focus because he was very low on his, because he was using tons of focus that turn for lots of different things. And he was feeding that turn, and he ended up leaving Butcher on 0 after feeding. So he didn't have the focus to Silence of Death himself. And so he ended up like hitting him twice, and then I just martyred him twice, and he just wanted to pull his hair out. He's just like,
ah! I mean, Silence of Death doesn't change that.
Doesn't it?
No, Silence of Death is just takedown. It is no longer Grievous Boot.
Oh, well, then it didn't matter. It did
probably
not.
One of the reasons he chose not to do it, because all it would have done is bypass the tough checks.
Yep. So that was our team tournament. Your plucky heroes won. It was fun. We had a really good time.
Yeah. I had a really, really good time at Renegade Open. Definitely something I'll go back to. Their venue can comfortably grow. So it's like, I would recommend more people go to that.
I would
too. It's out of the way. Like, it sure is way up north, but if you could make the drive to Minneapolis, it's well worth it.
I thought the prize system was pretty cool. So you just got points for like playing in the tournament, and you got points for winning the tournament. And then they had really great prize support. So I was able to get my War Machine Weekend release Champion of the Order of the Wall, which was a nice piece to be able to pick up. So I was happy with that.
Yeah, it was just like Iron Arena for everyone, basically. It was just a point buy system. So you didn't end up like, hooray, you won a random raffle prize. Here's something from a faction you don't play. And you're like, great. So it was like the prizes were something that you at least got to intelligently choose from the choices to get something that you were most likely to make you. So yeah, it was really cool. I had a number of solid games in the Steamroller. I also played against Tom. I found out that Coven are also fine into the Butcher 3 plays against Crick's plan. Now that I don't have Ghost Fleet, I was a little less excited about running the Satixus into that. But Coven did just fine. I had a really close game against a mercenary player, Tom Kleiss, because he was playing Damiana with lots of Deadeyes, and I just dropped Denny because I was looking at his Magnus list. I was like, oh, Magnus 2 to counter my scenario feat. Whatever, there's a bunch of Jacks in that list. I'm going to be great. And for whatever reason, I looked, I saw Damiano, and I was like, Damiano doesn't stop Denegra from being Denegra, so it's going to be fine. But we both made a couple of gaffes in that game, but it came down to me being behind on attrition, but up enough on scenario that I was able to force him into some questionable choices. And the same turn I was able to close it out on scenario, I also had a strong assassination against Damiano that went. But he had in his list was a unit of trenchers, a unit of rangers, and a full unit of crow's cutthroats. And had he not misdeployed, I guess, against ambush and let the blood witches get into the crows early, and had he not and had he got his nomads in the game a little sooner, because they weren't making attacks until I chewed through his steelhead halberdiers. Had they been in the game a little faster, I would have fallen much farther behind on attrition and not been able to pull as far ahead on scenario. That game actually, I think, was right around even as far as the matchup went. I just had a fortunate setup.
Doesn't Coven windmill that game, though?
Yeah, I definitely dropped the wrong list. I think Coven is very strong. Though not necessarily automatic, because it's so much infantry, and the Coven doesn't kill a lot of infantry that quickly.
That's true. Although that infantry has trouble killing Bane Cav once you're in the middle of his stuff. I suppose the Nomads can, though. Pretty easy, so.
I mean, it's a lot of power 11 charges. That does the job. Two attacks per Bane Cav. You go down pretty fast.
Fair enough. I actually had a couple really interesting games that I had alluded to. I got to play Jeff, who played Mosar. And let me tell you, the game with Harbinger against Mosar is a lot scarier when you don't have a book, when you can literally just pour it in at any time, bark, bark at you to lower your defense to 5, and then Harbinger automatically dies to whatever else.
Yeah.
It's real bad.
Because his guns were both sprays. It was like Scareth and a Pure Blood.
Yep, he had Scareth or Pure Blood.
Guards were irrelevant.
Yep. Yeah, anytime he wanted, he could have. Like, I had to be a little careful on the Martyrdoms, because anytime he wanted to, he could bring his Jacks forward and just put sprays on Harby. Now, because of the way Awe works, like, it's 11s to hit, so it's risky on his part. Like, he's putting his, you know, his eggs into rolling those 11s, and then he's giving his beasts away. Like, I 100% get to kill his beasts if he does that. So I managed to keep him from doing that, because I was always camping plenty on Harby to, you know, at least make the sprays not hurt that bad, and I never, like, martyred myself low enough where it got really, really exciting. But again, like I said, I had my feet turn to stop stuff from running into me and him getting ported there and killing me. But past that, I was like playing a game of, okay, got to keep Harvey like 15 inches away from every model that can run to her, and still be active in the game and still like martyr a little bit. It made for a very interesting game. Now, if I have the book, the game becomes really easy. I just say no spells, and then he doesn't ever want to come in because he doesn't get to bark, bark me and lower my defense to 5, because he doesn't get to cast that. And he does not very reliably kill her because of Awe. I mean, he just doesn't. I think he's only mat 5, is that right? Mosar? He might be mat 6, but.
Probably.
And so, yeah. And, yeah. He just doesn't have a good assassination. But that game was really funny because, I asked him if he had any way to attack me in my advanced deployment zone, if we could just do the math on his threat ranges. He goes, well, yeah, with Sands of Fate, I can put a crevasse, you know, like 3 inches into your advanced deployment. And I'm like, well, that's good to know. So I deploy everything within Harby's 10 inches. So he does that. He runs up. He goes to crevasse. I martyr it to stop crevasse from going off, which he was really sad about. So he traded 2 guys for none for 2 damage on Harby. And then as soon as I martyred it, he said he didn't have any protectorate players. So I felt a little bad about this. But he was like, he didn't know that could happen. And then he probably wouldn't have dropped Mosar. He was like, I have no way to kill all this infantry. Like, I've got a couple sprays, and it's really hard on him. If I take the crevasse away from him, it becomes a lot more difficult. So that was interesting. And then The other interesting game I had, besides our game, Keith, was against Matt Lust, which was, he was playing, Morvana One, who, I don't know, I looked at her card, we played our game, I thought I was gonna windmill that game, because I didn't realize she had, like, super duper, take D3 damage, stop you from purifying all my spells I need. And so I would, like, purify, and then he just took, like, 4 damage or something, and got to keep up regrowth and, harvest? Yeah. And so, but I did manage to get both of my jacks with Crusader's Call into his 3 wardens and kill them all. And then I double ones to a roll on some Idrians, and I left his battle engine on like 4, which kind of gave him some options. But the big thing I learned in this game was that, you know, we're like playing the game, and, you know, Matt's way behind on attrition. And so he decides to move Morvana up and just start influencing stuff. And I'm like, I look down and I tried not to stare at it, but Vilmon is standing right next to Harbinger. And I'm just like, if he influences Vilmon, I 100% die. But I've got 2 Forge Guard that are blocking line of sight to Vilmon. And so he's like, well, I guess I'll influence that Forge Guard to attack the other Forge Guard. I martyr myself down to 2, keeping that Forge Guard alive before he finally gives up on it. And I'm like, oh my god. But if he had like put more attacks into those Forge Guards, I don't think he saw it, but if he had put like, he could have put like everything into those 2 Forge Guards, move Morvana up, boost a influence on Vilmon. Vilmon just turns around and cuts Harbinger in half, and good game, sir. Like, that's just game over. So just like, I'm like, okay, note to self, make sure you find out if a caster does have influence, and Vilmon, who's going to be around Harby because he's a shield guard, so he's just there a lot. Just make sure that he doesn't have melee range to her. Probably a good pro tip. But then I guess the other game was Keith and I, we played in the finals.
Yep, we dropped, we agreed to play Scourge versus Tastem because we felt that it was worth testing. And the results were definitely interesting. It is not highly in favor of either caster, I don't think.
I think I agree with you there.
The Negra has an obvious, she's going to have most likely a tempo advantage. She's going to have an attrition advantage throughout the game, but she is in constant danger of, because she pushes so much focus onto the Testament. The spell assassination is very live against her if she doesn't have cover, which is not something that she can rely on having, even in 2017. And in subsequent turns, if she wants to stay relevant by casting spells, which is something that the pressure of recursion forces her to do, she doesn't get to reposition herself with such certainty that she can stay clear of the spell assassination, or sometimes even the Testament getting on her in melee, although that's something that I feel, in retrospect, I probably could have prevented.
Yeah.
I think that turn, that casting spells after the feat turn was just greed, and I should have just ran.
I would agree with that.
And just slogged for a turn. But I think the roll to go first is more important there for Testament than usual, because Denny grabs so much table space so quickly. Like, if you go first, my scenario game is not nearly as good.
No, if I go first, then I can afford to play a long attritional game with you and let the weight of recursion bring me back to the game, into the game eventually. Like, it probably takes until turn 6 before the tide turns, because you get so far ahead so early. But I think by the end of the game, the tide will turn. That's what it looked like would happen to me. I mean, I don't 100% know.
So short recap of the game. We were playing Barbell, and I got to go first, which let me set up positions to own the zones, which is my basic plan, was win on scenario. I'm never gonna be able to full clear units. I'm not going to be able to score any huge wins on attrition, but just grind down, make enough attacks every turn so that I'm not losing so much that I can't keep clearings. I felt like my big tech piece, my big advantage in this matchup was having the to be able to follow up after the raiders and dig deeper and do more damage, because positioning can prevent the raiders from doing more than superficial damage, even to units, just because I'll hit the front row and maybe grab a few guys behind them, but not be able to like really punish a unit. But with the Nis Hunters being able to follow up, like on my Alpha Strike, I was able to kill what, like 17 Errants or something like that.
Yeah, and then you killed some Knights Exemplar too, because I think, didn't I end up with 32 focus So yeah, you killed 26 models.
I killed 26 guys and owned the zones. You were able to come back and get models in the zones. In the following turn, I was able to... Also, you almost killed Denagro, but couldn't quite get your arc nodes clear to dispel me to death.
I mean, I think with better play, you could have prevented that. Put more Satixus Raiders in the middle, because I needed to kill, like, three.
Yeah.
In order to have...
Because of the stealth range, all you have to do to stop Denagro from getting spelled to death by an arc node that isn't Thorn is keep a goodly number of Satixus Raiders in an arc around her just outside of 3 inches. And if you layer them a little bit, it becomes nearly impossible to get LOS into stealth range with an arc node on her.
Yeah, and not be engaged. So,
yep.
And
that's going to become harder to prevent when you can still charge, but not impossible.
Yeah. And I think, I don't know that I had a great plan for that, but I was just trying to undig one arc node, and I kept, like, activating things, aiming with errands, taking shots, this, that, the other. And I ended up being, like, one witch short from being able to, like, fire off what I have, like, 30 focus at that point, because I allocated a couple, which would have been...
One raider lived on each side to stop either of the arc nodes from getting in range.
Yep, so that was frustrating.
A little closer than I would have liked.
Yeah, I think I said F you, Keith, at that point, and everybody around me was like, did John just lose? Because I put, like, enough attacks in where I felt like I should have been able to get my, at least, opportunity to roll dice to kill you right then. But
it certainly wouldn't have been outside of, like, a statistical...
Right.
Like, that would not have been an anomaly.
Right.
For you to hit it.
And it, to be fair, it wasn't an anomaly that I didn't get it cleared out either, like... Dice
it was
dice.
In that 60-40 one way or the other range, right?
Correct, yep. So I'm forced to instead put like 14 guys back or whatever. And one thing that was sort of interesting that was forced was I'm like, I'm going to kill Keith. So I committed the Devout. I put the Devout forward for some boosted attack rolls into Nis. Or not Nis, sorry, into Raiders to clear my Arc Node. And so after like... After I couldn't arc, I ended up bringing like, I don't know, 13 or 14 guys back. I think it was 13, cause I wanted to camp four. And then I had to bring Testament all the way up almost. I think he was almost in the square zone in the middle of barbell, right? Cause I had to put him in base to base with the arc node or else I just died. Like Testament just dies cause he just gets scourged, parasited, and then Nis hunters kill him or whatever. It just doesn't matter. He just dies. And so
yeah, Nightmare was up in the center rectangle, like. A lot of things could have gone.
Yep. And then I brought back 13 guys and jammed the crap out of you and sort of made a mess of things.
Yep. My next turn, the Raiders just dug through the models in the zone. It was actually kind of the Raiders didn't do as well that turn as I had hoped they would. Nightmare killed an Arc Node. But the other Arc Node was also in the center square zone, so I couldn't reliably clear that. Denegra tried to cast spells that turn and then advanced behind cover in the left-hand zone. And the reason that I decided on that plan was because I had made an error with the Satixus Raiders in that zone and left one outside of it. I had to get something in there to score. Same thing happened in the right-hand zone. The Raiders pushed past the zone and forced the Nis Hunters into kind of an awkward movement that limited their shots for that turn. I wasn't able to do as much work as I wanted to do that turn, but I was able to score 2 scenario points, which was kind of the main event. Also, I had forgotten to ambush my Blood Witches the previous turn, but this turn I got them onto the board and ran them into position to be effective.
Yeah, if you had remembered to deploy those the turn before, I think I might have been up against it pretty hard.
Yeah, because they come in and start threatening like whole units, because that's like your trailing back guys. I could have run into threat range of them, forcing them to either... run to stay out of that threat range, which would then obviously reduce the unit's efficiency somewhat if it was errants, for example, not being able to shoot.
Yep.
And then they would just be RFPing stuff, which is annoying.
It's quite good against me, for those of you keeping score at home. But anyway, because I committed to a plan that put the Devout forward, I put Testament forward, which allowed me to feat and get a charge on Denegra with like 20 focus on me.
I always forget what his feat does. For whatever reason.
Yeah.
And it's usually not relevant. It doesn't matter in like 2/3 of his games.
Yeah. Actually, it matters in every game I play, but it's mainly because I can dig so deep on my counterpunch. Like getting to charge through all your opponent's stuff is amazing.
So Texas Raiders.
I know. They all have magic weapons. And so this is actually a really good lesson, and Scott, this is a good lesson, I think, that a lot of maybe newer players won't take the time, but I was, you know, if I'm going to put my caster on your caster and I'm going to try and kill you, like, that's an all-in move. That is basically saying I either win or you win, because there's no chance of your caster surviving if you blow all your focus, or even if you just put your caster in the middle of their army on their caster, like, you're very likely to die in that situation. So that's going all in.
Estimate camping 25 doesn't live if he's face to face with the Negra.
Right.
Not that she's going to kill.
No, but everything else will. Right. So I'm just like, well, I'm going all in, and I got kind of excited because Keith doesn't make mistakes like that very often, like almost never. And I'm like, I'm going to kill this bastard right now. So I got excited, and I didn't put together the most efficient assassination that I could have, because the only way I could get Testament onto her was over an obstacle, part of a linear obstacle that she was grinding her cover, but it also meant that I would be minus 2 to hit her. So instead of needing 10s to hit her, I would need 12s. Now, I have 20 focus, so I get like 10 cracks at it, and I probably need to hit 3, maybe 4 to kill her, right? 3, because you're only camping 2. So 3 yep. has a reasonable expectation of killing you, I feel like. 3 hits. So anyway...
3 is decently likely to do it if I'm camping. 3 is reasonably likely to do it if I'm camping any number.
Yeah. Yep. And so I'm
at least has a shot.
Yeah, it has a shot. And then I also light you on fire, right? And so I'm like, this is pretty much automatic, right? This is the logic in John's brain right now. I'm like, I've got him. He made a mistake. He almost never makes mistakes like this. I will never get him to make this mistake again unless I put Testament away for 4 years and come back and play him like 4 years from now. Then it might happen, but probably not, because he'll still remember the time that I got Testament on him and killed him, right?
Yeah, it's going to be there for
him. Yeah, and I'm like, all right. And I could have, because Testament's only mat 6, my jacks are mat 6, I could have gotten one jack on him for sure outside of past the cover, right? So if I'd allocated 2 focus there and used that jack, I would have got a boosted 10 attack roll on her instead of the boosted 12 that I ended up taking by spending that 2 focus. And it would have been at +1 power, because I think I could have gotten a choir boy to him to get him his +2 to damage rolls. So that's number one. That would increase my odds of killing you. Number two, the Devout, I think, might have been able to get there, but I didn't allocate him any focus. I might have been able to position him so that he wasn't going over. That was less. I didn't have the opportunity to really check that, but that was less likely. But the Devout is mat 7 base, so even if I don't get the opportunity to avoid the cover, I still get the opportunity to hit you needing 11s instead of 12s. So, I mean, that also increases my odds of an assassination. It's also +1 power. So if I had allocated 4 focus to my 2 jacks, figured out where the jacks were going to be, make sure Testament could be there. Because here's the deal. I had like 20 or 25 minutes on my clock. I didn't have to hurt. I didn't have any time pressure to hurry. I was going all in. I could have put together the maximal assassination just to make sure that it went off. But instead, I got in a hurry, and I sort of just like, charge you with Testament, ha ha, and then didn't kill you. And then I had to like do the awkward thing where I shook your hand, and then I was like, wait a minute, I still can charge you with this jack, you know. and then I realized that I'm like, you know what, I probably could have engineered maybe even some other attacks. Like, I think there was one Knight's Exemplar that had line of sight to you that could have charged you had I cleared some Satixis Raiders with something not Knight's Exemplar. And they had not mini-feated yet, so they would have had Signs Importance, which, granted, is still not great to hit you, but it could have happened, right?
Possible.
Yeah, but I just didn't... I guess the point I'm trying to get at is I did not take the time to make sure I gave myself the best chance to win.
Yeah, it's definitely a good lesson. When you know that this is it, like, make use of your time, double check your math, write your plan, execute deliberately.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah, I've actually done that a couple of times. I remember watching a battle report a long time ago, and it was Keith, I think, versus Jay. It was in a 75-point gauntlet round where Jay essentially had brought Doomshaper just a little too far forward. And so that's not the important part. The important part is I learned an important thing. I saw Keith take his army sheet or something, sheet of paper, flip it over, and then just start writing down What I can only assume is the order of activations and the different things that need to be done in order to pull off this assassination.
Yep, and I learned that from Colin Hill.
Yep, Colin Hill is the man. I've seen him do like a 14-step plan for an assassination before, which is just amazing.
Colin Hill's he's an amazing guy. Like, I got to meet him at War Machine Weekend one year, and yeah, he's super cool. But it's really interesting. It's something that I try to keep myself in the habit of. Something else I do is if I get really stuck on something and I don't really know what to do, but I know I'm running out of time, I'll go ahead and I'll just make like the snap reaction to just choose to do it. And then what I'll do over the course of my opponent's next turn, when they're like dismantling my plan or whatever, or if I think of something better, I'll write it down. That way I can kind of stop and use that as a memory jog. So I can kind of explore mentally like the things that I didn't do as well. So excuse me again. Oh my. So I do try to use tools like that to help me learn. Especially whenever I'm mathing stuff in my head. And I don't know why I do that, because we have smartphones and we have all this technology and there's all these super sweet apps out there that can do the math for us. But for some reason, I just get stuck wanting to do it in my head. And so when I'm doing that, like a lot of times, like I'll write down the math or I'll try to like get a little bit better ideology. And I found that once I actually start like committing myself to writing it down, there are two things that actually happen. The first one is, when I'm writing down the steps and sequences, I'll catch holes in my plan that I didn't think about. It's like going back and proofreading something that you just wrote. Like, you might catch something that you didn't see before. And then the other thing that actually helps is that when I do that, it helps solidify the plan in my head as if this is going to be the right thing or not. The problem is I'm inconsistent with applying that, because there are some games where you just kind of get stuck in the moment and like you're just caught up in it. You're just like, I got 17 minutes left on my clock. I've got about 30 points left out of my 75-point army or my 100-point army. My opponent's got like 35 points or 40 points or 20 points or whatever. And I'm like, gotta make a decision. Okay, go. And then I won't even think about it. And then I'll just get like stuck and wired up and amped up. And I'll be like, all right, go. And then I'll miss a key activation, or I'll goof up on something, or I'll get something out of or in the incorrect order. And then I find myself like, looking at the table going like, yeah, it's probably not smart to put Doomshaper there, like in direct line of sight or in direct charge lane to, you know, ruin or whatever. Like that's probably not the smartest move. And so like once I realize that's what I'm about to do, like I end up having to like contort my turn and stuff. So there's definitely advantages to it, but I always kind of get stuck with like, even though it helps me avoid analysis paralysis, it's not necessarily a problem of using the technique of writing stuff down. It's remembering to do it often enough and then executing on it even when you're crunched on time. Like those are the things that I actually have trouble with that. But you're right, John. It's a really good lesson to bring up, because I think, and I'm at the risk of digressing here unnecessarily, but I think a lot of times newer players, and even like I don't consider myself a new player. I consider myself a reasonably well-experienced player. Note that that does not translate into a good player. It just means that I've played enough games that I don't think of myself as new. But I think it's very easy for most players to kind of get stuck in that loop where you're just failing to activate, or you're failing to assess like what the right plan is. Do you think it's worth it? Say I get stuck in a situation like that and I'm looking at the table and I'm like, all right, well, I've got these three veins of play with Kolgrimma, or I've got these three veins of play with Denegra One. And to sit there and kind of like try and map them out, say I've got 15 minutes left on my clock, say that sitting down and trying to map that out is worth, I don't know, 5 minutes of time. Is it worth it? Do I gain enough efficacy out of a more streamlined decision-making process, or even just better decisions, to make up those 5 minutes I lost? Because chances are that's going to put me on the negative swing of playing on the clock, right? So I guess that's my question, is when you're looking at that, like, how do you prioritize doing that, especially whenever the game kind of moves on?
Muscle memory.
Yeah, it's sometimes it's – I mean, there's no clear answer. There's no guaranteed method, but – the idea is you've got to have a good notion of where the game is going to go. Like if you're playing for attrition, how many more turns before you think you've got things mopped up? and make sure that you have enough time to do that. Like, you just have to have an idea of how much time is necessary to achieve the victory that you're aiming. Sometimes with Haley 3, my plan is always make sure that I have enough time to play the 7 turns if it comes to that. Even if I only get my last couple turns as 1 minute, as long as I have enough time, make sure that I can take those turns and do a couple key activations. With Crix, I pay almost no attention to the clock whatsoever because the game will end before that point. Like, Crix is not a turn 5, 6, 7 faction. It's a turn 2, 3, 4 faction. So it just, depending on the list. I mean, I'm sure it's possible to build late game, long grind Crix lists, just not the kind that I build. So it's just a question of knowing your list and your victory conditions that are available to you and the time it takes to execute those victories. And certainly things can happen. Like, when I'm playing against more thoughtful opponents, I tend to get more thoughtful myself because I'm worried that they're seeing something that I'm not seeing. So I take a little bit more time to look at things. But keeping the two important factors are either A, just make sure that you yourself have enough time left to play the game you want to play, or B, keep clock parity with your opponent. If you don't know how much time you need, then queue off your opponent. It's easy enough to, as long as you're both, both of your clocks are in the same general area, to still be fit to be able to take that to the end of the game.
So that begs an interesting question, and I'm kind of spinning this, I'm pivoting on this to a different point, but when you're talking about clock pressure, like, I know most of the time if you maintain parity with your opponent, chances are the game will not end decided on clock. Like, chances are, as long as you're maintaining parity with your opponent, like, the game will come to a natural conclusion outside of the clock. But what is there a time frame? Is there kind of like a generic, like, you need to stay within 1 minute of your opponent's time, 2 minutes of your, 3, 5, 10, whatever. Is there like a generic frame in which you want to maintain parity to your opponent?
There's no answer to that because it depends on.
Yeah, within 3 is probably fine for like the most generic when you're in the early turns. If your plan is just maintain, if you're just trying to stay with enough time to play and you're not sure exactly how much time your plan requires. Maintaining, like, after you've both taken the same number of turns, being within 3 minutes of each other is totally fine.
What's interesting for me, what I find is I'm often not at parity with my opponents on time. I'm usually behind early because I am a thoughtful player, and I will take my time, if I can, to optimally place my models, which is maybe a bad habit. But I do find that as time starts winding down, I'm better. I get more and more efficient with my turns. I prioritize better, and I almost always end up finishing my games with, you know, a good minute left on my clock. I just sort of naturally manage it as I play the game, because you know, I have also set myself up with situations where I have like a minute and a half to clear a zone, so which maybe isn't ideal. But I think one of the things I can work on is developing a little more sense of urgency in the early turns. I guess this is the point I was trying to get to. I don't play urgently turns 1, 2, 3 often.
Yeah, and that comes from having the experience with your list to know the time that it takes you to play your game, right? You're not worried about what your opponent's clock says because you know that you have enough time to do what you want.
Yep.
And that's how I generally play.
I play very intuitively, and I always have sort of an overall macro strategy that my list is sort of designed to do, but the tactics varies very much from game to game. Like, I'll just look down and, like, I was looking at the terrain against Quimby, for example, in our Haley 3 versus Testament game, and I looked at the way the terrain was laid out, and I was like, if I dust-to-dust 3 of my own guys, I create a cloud wall where he doesn't get to make very many attacks against me at all, and I get to come on the approach, and then I get to run and jam, and, you know, I don't lose that much stuff. So I did that. I killed 3 of my own guys with dust-to-dust, made a ghetto cloud wall, and prevented Quimby from killing a lot of models. But that's not something that I would do in very many games. Like, my opponent has to have enough threatening stuff to me that I care about, and I have to have terrain in a certain way, and the terrain has to be far enough up the board where I feel like I'm gaining enough ground. Like, I don't know. There's very little in War Machine that is, like, rote execution the same way every time, at least for me. I know some people do that. Like, I've seen people who play the same way every time they play. They unpack their army the same way. They, you know, prioritize the same way there are targets, and that's just not how I play War Machine. Like, every matchup game, everything is like a different puzzle to unlock, and there's a lot of small advantages to be gained.
Do you think that's namely because, like, people often struggle to identify how important turn one is? Like, because I hear a lot of players say things like, well, all I'm going to do is run. And it's like, well, yeah, but how you deploy and where you're running is a really, really important thing, right? So my favorite thing is, like, the symmetrical deployment. Like, I love symmetrical deployments. Because if my opponent deploys symmetrically after I've deployed, then, like, yeah, I mean, most of the time, if you have really fast elements, you may be able to take advantage of that. You may be able to keep them off balance. Or you can just put an answer so hard on one side that he can't necessarily deal with. Or maybe he deploys symmetrically when he should have deployed in like a counter formation. Like, I've seen that a lot too. I'll deploy first and I'll throw out whatever it is I'm playing, right? A whole bunch of jacks or whatever. My opponent then deploys, and he'll deploy with like both of his jacks next to his warcaster, and then both of his units on next to the jacks, and then the support. Like, and he tries to make it look pretty. And then when he runs, or when my opponent takes that first turn, like, it's almost like they go on autopilot, right? And so, like, they're just running forward as fast as they can, and they're not necessarily paying attention to like what kind of like matchups they're going to draw on the table.
The rule of thumb is first player deploys symmetrically, second player should deploy intelligently.
Right. Yeah, and I wonder how much of that is just based on the fact that I think sometimes people don't necessarily realize how important turn one unpacking is, and that they don't realize, like, and much to John's point earlier, they don't realize that, you know, like, this is probably, like, this is one of the most crucial things you can do in the game. So it's really important. Is this something that you do want to take extra time on? Because a lot of people, I think, look at turn one as just a way to, like, I'm going to play this turn in 3 minutes or less. I'm going to blast everything out, run everything up, and then slam that clock, and I'm done. But the reality to it is that, I mean, is it probably worth more, or at least I would think it would be worth more, to play that turn as intelligently as possible, because you're going to set up the tempo for the rest of the game, right? That's kind of what's going to happen.
It is a beautiful game. I do enjoy it.
Sorry, did what I say make any sense, or was I off target? Or
no, you're fine, Scott. Like, there's a lot of important phases to the game of War Machine. I actually open pretty standardly with Testament. Truth be told, I'm just I'm basically setting up the smorgasbord for my opponent. I'm running forward and saying, "Hey, kill what you can." I kind of want you to, because it's good for me. You know, the things I'm making sure is that every model that runs forward is in Testament's control area, so I don't get denied any souls. But I guess there's some flexibility in that, too, because you have to, like, be cognizant. I got caught off guard in the LCQ by the list healer because it denies soul collection. So I could have run and then made, like, a bubble divot to where the Nis healer can run to... I mean, she was still going to be able to deny me some souls, but she wouldn't have been near as effective had I played around it, which is possible. I don't know. I think it's been a pretty good cast. Do you guys have anything else you want to talk about? Or
no, I really don't. I don't think there's anything else of value that I'm going to bring to this.
Oh, there's... Quit saying stuff like that. There's tons of value you're going to bring to it. So
No. I mean, in this specific conversation, like, I had
several people, at least two people, tell me that they really enjoyed you on the podcast this weekend.
I also...
Particularly because you're able to ask questions to start good conversations, as well as contributing to them.
Well, tell those guys I love them.
I'm sure you just did. They're clearly listeners. So Scott.
But I think that is a wrap for this week.
I do have one more question.
All right.
Just a minor one. So, Scott, you're now switching to Crix. Is that true?
Right, so, after you did a troll-isode. To bolster the community that you are so proud of, you're switching to the greatest enemy of trolls.
This is not fair. This is not fair at all.
Why is it not fair? Are you not switching to... I mean, you were asking Keith for list advice and what to buy. I mean, I swear I saw that conversation. I didn't imagine that, did I? Keith, did that happen?
No. You didn't imagine that because you were the one who recommended that I do so.
You said you wanted to win.
Yes, that's part of that conversation. And then you also made the comment that you had some advice for me, which was just to put Crix on the table and run forward. And I figured, being the amazing player that you are, and how much you love to tell everybody how amazing you are, it would be foolish of me not to listen to your advice.
Wait a minute. I don't tell anybody how amazing I am.
I'm seriously considering Cricks. I'm still going to keep playing. I love Trolls. There's no doubt about it. I'm super passionate about Trolls.
Right, but when you want to win, you're going to take the Cricks out. Is that what you're saying?
So there's actually two trains of thought that I've been kind of looking at this. And this is the honest, this is the hot take, this is the honest take on it, though. I've been looking at playing Brent's Legion for a little bit. I have a bunch of Circle stuff that's sitting at home. I mean, like, I have the faction minus a couple of Warbeasts or something. And then I'm looking at Cricks. Like, I think I love Trolls, love what they do. But I don't necessarily think that it's going to be bad for me to play something else. I don't think it's going to be bad enough for me to play something else because I think it's going to broaden my horizons a little bit. I think it would do me a lot of good to see the world through something that's very different. One thing that Keith has told me offline, though, is that the Magic list that he built that I will be piloting the hell out of is probably close enough to the game plan that I'm going for. And honestly, I'm not really sure. I mean, I make jokes, John, about you recommending me play Cricks, but I know you were being tongue in cheek when you said that.
Only so partially. I mean, I honestly believe if your primary goal is to win games and that is your driving force, then it makes the most sense to play Cricks right now, in my opinion. They have the best list pairs that are probably a little bit easier to pilot. Not easy. War Machine's never an easy game, but they have a low floor. Like, they're going to do well because of their game plan and sheer power, and they're just really built to play into 2017 scenarios. So, yes, it was tongue-in-cheek, but it's also, I don't necessarily disagree with it. Like, I mean, I figure if you're going to sell out, you might as well sell out for the best bid you can get, Scott. That's all I'm saying.
Well, I mean, that's not bad logic. I mean, to be completely transparent, because I don't want the Troll Blood listeners to freak out when they hear this, because I love Trolls.
Oh, I do.
I know you do.
Them to light you on fire.
You are waiting for them to stand outside of my door with pitchforks and torches. I get it. It's actually a hard decision for me, what to play, because there's obviously a lot of great factions out there. I love the game. I'm absolutely crazy about the game. In all of its incarnations. So, for me, playing Trolls is amazing, but I also really want to qualify. It's, to be completely transparent, it's humbling to be in the presence of so many great players, right? So, like, every week I jump on a podcast with, you know, you and Keith and Brent, and then I jump on another podcast with Brandon Shirley and Carl Jones and, a lot of really, really excellent players. I think at some level I'm kind of looking at that success and I'm like, how do I accelerate myself to get down that path? Because I want to be in that realm, right? Like, that's a goal. That's something I want to do in the game. And I think I have to look at myself realistically and I have to analyze, much like you said, John, if that is my only goal, then am I doing everything as efficaciously as possible to get me towards that goal? And if a better play style suits me better, if something is just inherently more powerful because it is just rules as written a little stronger than what I'm doing now, then I probably owe it to myself to explore that, right? And I'm not being a sellout by doing that, right? Because it kind of feels like I am. And
you would only be a sellout if you were a community leader for Trolls and set up like a podcast just about that faction. Then you would probably be labeled a sellout, but otherwise, I think you're in the clear.
Pretty much.
So, thank you for turning it.
I'm definitely the nice one, Scott. I'm kidding. I'm just busting your balls a little bit. You're not a sellout. Don't get defensive. It's fine.
No, I mean, yeah.
Ultimately, you engage the game however you would like to engage the game. Because that's a personal decision for everybody to make their own decisions, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And much to Keith's point, like, I do need to play that Madrak one list a little bit more and see if it gets the play style that I'm hunting for that I can pair off with the other stuff that I want to do. So I much to the point that both you and Keith have made, I'm probably jumping the gun on things a little too quickly. And I owe it to myself to explore all of my options before I start sinking, another $800 into a faction.
That's probably fair.
Yeah. I mean, I would be backpedaling, too, if somebody was busting my balls.
All right, everybody. Let's call it a day.
Thanks, so you know the good.
Tuning in again to this episode 334 of Muse on Minis. This is Keith.
John.
This has been Scott.
Brent's still here.
I think he had to drop.
Oh, all right. Brent was here, totally. Good night, everybody.
Good night. Why do you hate Brent? Also, Scott, can you turn up your volume a little bit? I'm not hearing you too well.
Yeah, give me just a second here.
I thought I was the likable guy.
No, I'm the nice one. We've established that.
I mean, have we?
I feel like we have. One of us has won the first ever Focus and Fury Sweet Bee. One of us has won the Explosive Award for Sportsmanship at War Machine Weekend. So, I don't, you know, you guys could dismiss me if you want, but those things don't just happen to anybody. They happen to nice people.
Is there an option to adjust your gain in Skype?
I'm sure there is, and I'm sure I have no idea how to. Although I'm picking you up a little bit better now. Maybe you're just speaking more into your mic. I'm not sure what the dealio is.
It's probably a combination of both. Device settings.
Yay, Skype preamble. Have you guys watched Punisher yet?
I started.
It's off to a really good start. I watched the first, like, 10 minutes. And then got busy, so I didn't get a chance to watch all of it. But it looks like it's going to be really strong. So
I did have a friend of mine say that about episode 10, it was real hard to just get through.
Yeah.
It hit the Netflix mid-season slump. But I will probably watch it in 6 months from now, which is what I average on Netflix shows.
Why do you wait so long?
Because when my wife is home, we end up watching cooking shows or Grey's Anatomy or over and over.
I feel so sorry for you. Oh, poor Brent.
I will say the thing I love about The Punisher is that the John Bernthal's Punisher, like, he is a very – it's really interesting the way he portrays the character. It's very true to, like, the late 80s, early – like, mid-80s, late 80s, maybe a little bit early 90s, like – Punisher, like the Punisher War Journal, Punisher War Zone, like the way he gives that personality life. It's very similar. Like he acts a lot of the ways that I kind of imagine the Punisher acting when I was a kid reading the comic books. And I never really read a lot of comic books except the Punisher. Like I love Punisher. So it's really cool to see him do that, because I think he does an excellent job bringing that character to life. Like even his mannerisms are really good. Like just that really matter of fact, smarmy, smart aleck, dryly sarcastic tone. Like it's really good. Like it's a great series. It's well worth watching.
I'm excited for it. Have you guys seen Justice League yet?
I have not.
I have not either. I've been told it's both really good, and then I've been told that it is good for a DC movie. And I can't get anyone to agree. So
well, let's talk about that for just a second, because I think people are being really unfair to DC, because if you look at the very first five movies in the Marvel Expanded Universe, they're not great movies. Iron Man was really good, and then it's The Incredible Hulk was the second movie in their Expanded Universe, which was not a great movie, right?
Incredible Hulk wasn't. It wasn't done by them. They haven't done a Hulk movie yet.
Yes, it was. That was the Iron Man came out, and then the next movie they did was Ed Norton as the Incredible Hulk. I promise you.
The Ed Norton Hulk has continuity in that. Oh. It is the Hulk.
Yep. And then Iron Man 2, which we can agree is not a great movie. Right? The original Thor and then Captain America. And I think if we chart the first five DC Universe movies, they match up pretty well, right? You've got Man of Steel. I think that's better than The Incredible Hulk, right? Batman versus... I think Man of Steel is definitely better than The Incredible Hulk. The Incredible Hulk was not like The Abomination, and it was not a great movie. All I'm saying is that there's all this Marvel fanboyism, and if you actually just chart back and forth, like, would you agree that The Incredible Hulk and Man of Steel are in the same ballpark?
Yeah,
okay.
I would agree with that.
You think that Batman versus Superman you could compare to, Thor or Iron Man 2?
I'd say Iron Man.
Okay. Suicide Squad obviously is a stinker, but I would say that honestly Iron Man 2 is also a stinker. Wonder Woman I think equates very well to Captain America, and having seen Justice League I would put in the ballpark with Iron Man, you know. Maybe not quite as good.
Wow, that good, huh?
Yeah, it's very good. It's so it suffers from the same problem that all ensemble movies suffer from, which is you can't do character development very well in an ensemble movie. But the things that I will say are very, very good. Wonder Woman is amazing. She's just amazing. She's flat out amazing in this movie too. Like, in a lot of ways, she's kind of the soul of the whole group, which I appreciate. But yeah. So for me, I don't know. I get kind of annoyed with all the DC bashing that goes on, because if I look at the Marvel movies, they're very comparable in what they've put out. Marvel's had a few really, really good movies, right? But so has DC. If you go back, like, I would say Dark Knight is probably the best comic book movie of all time, or in the discussion with Heath Ledger's Joker and all of that.
I don't know if I could argue that.
Well,
any of the Nolan Batman movies, I think, are...
The third one's not great, but the first two are very good. The second one is great. The first one is very good. The third one is better than average, I would say, for a superhero movie. But, you know, everybody just bashes on DC, like DC has never done anything, but in my opinion, DC has put out some of the best comic book movies of all time, and they've put out some stinkers. So they've got high highs and low lows, and Marvel has kind of put out a lot of fluff. They've put out a couple of really good movies, and most of their movies are fairly forgettable or just okay, in my opinion. But people fanboy harder for Marvel for some reason, and they love to hate on DC. It's like hipster and cool to hate on DC, so that's what happens. And anyway, that's just my two cents on the whole matter. I don't know. I just get a little bit annoyed because I hear people all the time, they're just like, oh, well, DC just doesn't know how to make movies. And I'm like, well, DC's made some pretty good movies, and Marvel has made some pretty good movies too, and I super enjoy them. Like, a lot of them are very, very good. But some of them, not so great. So.
Yeah, I can kind of see what you're saying. Like, there's been a couple of Marvel movies that I've walked out of the theater kind of scratching my head on. Like, the second Avengers movie, every one of my friends were just cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs over it, screaming it was the best movie ever made. And I'm kind of scratching my head, and I'm like, you know, it was fun. Like, it was a fun movie, but I don't necessarily know that. I guess I just don't go quite that far with it. So I understand what you're saying. Like, that makes sense. I think a lot of people, like, and in a way, I guess comic book movies probably have to be like the worst movies to make ever. Because everybody has like their own ideology of what they think the characters are and how they would act and all this other stuff. And so like, you can never live up to that expectation.
Well,
that's why books are always better than movies.
Yeah, right? Not only that, but how many different iterations have there been of every comic book hero? So the Superman that was running around in the '50s is not the same Superman that's running around today in the comics, right? Like, they've all evolved or changed over time. So you, not only can you not live up to the expectations laid out by the comic books, but they're different for all the characters at different periods of time or with different writers. Like, you know, the characters do change. Like, a lot of the core is still there, but they definitely have changed over time.
I think maybe just a lot of fans felt like really burned from like Green Lantern, like the Ryan Reynolds Green Lantern movie.
Can I just say that I actually really enjoyed that movie? I like that movie. I know it's a terrible movie, and I'm a terrible person for saying that I liked it, but I love Green Lantern.
If you're a fan of the comics, it's good. It's really good.
Yeah.
It really tied into the comic.
I'm not like a huge fan of the comics, but I'm a huge fan of Ryan Reynolds, so I didn't think it was the worst movie ever made. I didn't think it was particularly good.
The source material is pretty hard to bring into a believable sense, like in a movie. I mean, the guy makes giant ham-hocked fists out of green energy and punches people with it. Like, it just doesn't – it's not something that translates into, like, reality. Because movies tend to be a little bit more real, a little bit grittier, and they're not as whimsical as, say, a medium like anime or cartoons or a comic book. Like, you just have a different set of expectations. So I don't know. I'm not sure you could translate Green Lantern into something. But then again, I didn't think Guardians of the Galaxy could be translated into something that would be – something that would work in a movie, and it clearly did. So I'm probably wrong about that. But
it did the first time.
Also, Ant-Man.
Yeah.
Oh, good call. That was a good movie.
But
Did you see the picture, by the way, of somebody dressed up as Black Panther standing in an Amazon box with the caption, "If it fits, I sits"?
No.
I'll dig it up. It's hilarious because it's a parody of all the cat things floating around.
That's funny. Have you – I heard a new pun this weekend while I was at the Renegade Open. And I thought I thought it was going to go in a really dark place. I was like, I'm not comfortable right now, but it starts out – how do you find Will Smith in the snow?
I know this one. I actually know this one. Go ahead.
I'm not sure I want an answer to that, and I'm not sure we want to record this.
Scott, you follow the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. Get it? Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. Come on.
I get
it. Come on. That's pretty good, right? It's better than any pirate joke. Better than any pirate joke.
That's not better.
100%.
The puns are so horrible.
So this is my New Year's resolution, by the way. I'm fighting back next year. Next year is going to be dad jokes every episode. I'm bringing a new one. That's 100% happening, and you guys deserve
I actually had one of Gina's friends ask if Gina was pregnant because I kept telling so many bad puns. She's like, these are all dad jokes.
So you're 100% in support of all dad jokes 2018?
Oh, absolutely.
No.
Absolutely. Also cocky 2018.
No. Brent, we can't say that.
Dang it, Brent. Now I have to edit this. I have to So terrible.
Right?
Now I'm really not going to do those chargers for you. You understand that, right?
You're going to do them.
You will. I'm going to bat those eyes at you.
You don't have Jake Van Meter eyes.
I don't. If it was
Jake Van Meter eyes, I'd probably do it because it's the prettiest eyes of War Machine, but... You don't. I'm sorry. You just don't. All right. Well, while we're waiting, looks like we're still trying to get Keith and Josh, right?
I don't know if Josh is going to make it. It sounded like he might bail. But okay. I will try to text Keith. Gosh, I'm disappointed that neither one of you has seen Justice League. How about Stranger Things 2? Have you watched that?
No, I sure haven't. I've been crazy inundated with work. We had a couple things happen, and it's taken a lot of time. So
It's been bad lately.
Yeah, you just got back from Mexico City, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I would say, how was the trip? Work trips are never as fun as you
think. It was actually really good. I got to meet 9 of my employees for the first time, so.
That's pretty cool. Did you guys go out and party like rock stars?
No, I was in the super safe area. Plus, they had to they couldn't stay out too late because most of them had an hour or two commute. So they couldn't stay out late because of that to get home safely.
What, is that a real thing? Like, it's not safe to go home after a certain hour at Mexico City?
They told me that they need to leave by a certain time or public transit shuts down. Issues like that.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, we... Go ahead, Scott.
I was going to say, that was really common. In, I spent like 6 months in Panama City, Panama for work. And while I was there, it was pretty crazy. Like, as a non-national, I would, if, like, I could walk... This is the place where my corporate hotel was in like the downtown Multicentro area, like right next to like the Hard Rock Cafe Panama. There's like this huge, like really upscale mall. The parking garage for the apartment that I stayed in had like Lamborghinis and Bentleys and stuff in it. So like I stayed in a very upscale area. But the people I was with and the security at the hotel I was at, or at my apartment or whatever, they told us constantly, like, you don't go anywhere except where we tell you you can go. You never go to a place where you cannot be seen by at least three other people. And if you want to leave this area and go explore the city or whatever, you need to let us know so we can schedule armed guards.
That's interesting. So it kind of reminds me of, I spent a year in Iraq and I would venture occasionally into the green zone or the neutral zone or whatever you want to call it, which was fairly safe, but you still had to be smart and sort of have your head on a swivel. It's interesting, like, how much we take for granted living in the United States, or a lot of Western countries honestly have a lot of that, to be honest. But Keith says he'll be on momentarily. Nigel is sick as a dog, poor guy.
Oh, that sucks. Get better, Nigel. I need my update tokens for my troll pack, buddy.
Why? You're playing Crix?
Oh, yeah. It's a good point.
Also, just for the record.
I do love my trolls, though. I love my trolls.
You love them so much, you drop them like a bad habit as soon as you found something better.
I mean, no, not really. Because, like, I still... Uh-huh. If I didn't love trolls, I wouldn't have the faction painted to the standard that I painted it.
Uh-huh.
Like, it's something that I legitimately just love. Like, I love trolls.
So you love them so much you won't even play them this year? Or next?
John?
Yeah?
I think he's actually saying the person who revitalized troll interest and troll bloods on the Facebook is now saying the best place for them is on the shelf.
Yep, it's like Elf on the Shelf. It's Troll on the Shelf,
where
right?
They're painted.
Yeah.
Not what I'm...
You could just look at them longingly. I wish you were good enough to come down on the table and play, boys, but... Sorry, I'm going to play these
really
undead models instead.
Yeah. I really miss playing troll infantry, but every other infantry in the game is just better.
Yep.
By that, I mean...
Yep. I felt a little betrayed. I was talking to Bryn, who's like my protectorate buddy. I talk protectorate shop with all the time. He's moving into Signar. He's going to play Haley 3 all next year. I'm like, you power-hungry POS. You and Scott Taylor. That's just it. Just going for the cheap victories. That's fine. I will continue to play hard mode and play protectorate.
Hard mode?
Oh, believe me, Scott, you would not last 2 weeks playing Protectorate. It is hard mode.
What? What? Like, you realize I play Trolls before CID, right? I don't even want to hear about hard mode from a Protectorate player. No, I played Trolls before CID.
Hard mode,
like,
buddy.
Let's talk about hard mode.
Yeah?
Don't worry,
let's talk about hard mode when you have the book. Let's. Oh, what is this shit? What is this stuff? Like, let's talk about hard mode when you have, like, Harbinger and Martyrdom, and let's talk about Testament and the ever recurring dudes that are all weapon masters at Matt's. Oh,
yeah. Let's talk about the 1416 doofus that we put in the middle of the board that everybody and their mother has a chance to kill every single turn. So you have to play like super crazy. Or let's talk about Harbinger, who's like OP, right? Who martyrs down to like 4 or 5 life every turn, and you've got to put her within 10 inches of all the stuff you want to martyr. And so she's also in the middle of the board and can be killed at any moment. And every game I play is like a 2-hour slogfest. Trust me, Protectorate is the hardest faction that is good enough to win with right now.
Is it better than, or is it harder than Convergence?
To win with? I'm not sure. Yes, I think it is harder to win with Protectorate than it is with Convergence. Because with Convergence, all you have to really do is make sure your teps don't die. I mean, that's pretty much it. So if you – what?
Excuse me for a few minutes, guys. I got to go take an anti-nauseal. So I'll be back in like 5 minutes, all right?
All right. I made him nauseous?
I think so.
Well,
I think so. I think it was guilt, actually, to be honest.
Well, I can't believe he's actually picking up cricks. This is not going to go as well for him as he thinks. I promise.
So you'll have good company in Minoth next year.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. I think some other people are going to be picking it up.
Really?
Yeah.
Who's picking it up?
I'll message you.
Okay. Is this a secret?
I don't know if it is or isn't.
Oh. Oh, that literally doesn't matter, the one you just sent me.
I mean, are you certain?
Yeah, I'm super certain. He won't last more than.
Where y'all at over the weekend? By the way,
what's that? Renegade Open in Minneapolis. It's really fun. Keith and I, and Keith brought it around Quimby, who's from Madison. We played in the team tournament and we did pretty well. Although I did almost get Doom Spiraled to death. That was a thing.
I think I've seen that happen once.
Yeah, Doom Spiral into somebody else's Jack. I was on 9 life. He had mana for 4 Doom Spirals. He had to roll a 6 for damage on every... Like, hitting was like a no-brainer. I think it was like on a 3+. But he had to roll a 6 for damage on the Doom Spirals. And then he had to average... Because he could hit 4. So he had to average over 2 damage per. So a little above average. But 4 sixes in a row didn't happen. And I lived. But the first 2 damage rolls he rolled was 3 and 3. Which completely changes the odds of me dying, because now he just needs, you know, another 2 sixes, and then on average I die, or a 6 followed by, you know, a 5 or a 6, and both of those things kill me. So that was like a pretty big pucker moment, because go ahead.
I was going to say, I did see a Doom Spiral assassination fail once when the guy killed the Jack from spiking rolls before he killed the caster.
Lame. Although,
all right, I'm back.
I was thinking about it, Morten Ebber in the Satixis theme is kind of funny, because you you could feedback him and then Doom Spiral him and just get the cheesiest victories ever. Like, just cheeseball the heck out of victories. Also, pro tip, I didn't get killed by this, but I sure could have. If you're playing Harbinger and you're going to martyr yourself down to 2 life, maybe don't park Vilmon in melee range of you against a caster that can cast Influence.
That seems rough.
Yep. I look down and I'm like, because I forgot to activate Vilmon, you know, and and he's just standing there like looking at Harvey like, hey, what's up? Right in his melee range. I'm like, oh, God, she's going to die. I just martyred this one hammer dwarf over and over again. And I don't know if my opponent understood why I was martyring him, but he was blocking line of sight from to Vilmon, who was behind a wall. So I was just like, well. Neither of these 2 hammer dwarves can die, because then he can get line of sight to Vilmon, and then I just die. So I martyred myself down to 2, keeping that one hammer dwarf alive. And then I finally let him go after Morten Ebber spent her last 2 for influence, and I was like, woo! It was pretty scary, though.
Are we expecting Nigel, or no, he's out sick.
He is super sick. I was just telling these guys how I almost got Doomer Spiral to death and how I almost got Vilmon influence to kill me.
Yep, I heard.
Yep. We actually haven't started the podcast yet, though. You guys should go with us to Renegade next year. It was pretty fun.
That's a long way away from these guys.
Yeah. It's also 2 weeks after War Machine Weekend.
Yeah, that's the big one. I need to get Adepticon figured out. I need to figure out what I'm doing for Adepticon. I need to get with Squirrely Shirley and...
You already have a room booked out?
No, I don't.
No,
I don't. I know you and I had talked briefly about a few things. I don't know. I'll hit you up afterwards and see if you can point me in some right directions. So,
I mean, Gonzo may have space.
I don't think he does. I don't know. I'll figure it out, though.
Scott, we might be able to help you out. I usually book a couple of muse rooms. So when I go to do that, I'll ping you and see if you still need a spot.
Okay.
I talked to my boss first week of January or first week of December. I'm really think I can get her to just let me stay in Ontario for an extra couple days, John.
Cool. So then the OTC is a go.
Yeah.
Nice. Keith, you were going to register us for the ATC?
Oh, got it. I will do that now. America.
So am I still the team manager? Is that how this works?
Do you want to go and be part of it, Scott? You are certainly
unless
welcome.
You're playing in solos. If you want to play in solos. Otherwise, you...
Actually, that's not the worst idea I've ever heard. Solos should be a pretty easy... like way to get on the WTC team.
It's not a guaranteed thing.
What do you
mean?
It's
not a guaranteed thing. I forget where I read it, but they were basically saying that there is an attendance requirement on the solo masters, if I remember correctly. That, like, if it's below X value, and I don't know what X is, then it won't have a WTC team slot on it.
They haven't announced it yet that I've seen. It's more than 8, and it's either 16 or 32 in all likelihood.
I mean, it should be like 64, but whatever. It'll be hard to fill that with the ATC going on, so I get it.
Sure.
Really, there should be...
They're just trying to avoid the 8-man.
Right. There should be a different singles tournament that would be on a different weekend that could qualify for that.
Yeah, that makes the most sense to me. But
yeah, I'll talk to Travis about that and see if we can maybe figure...
The team tournament, the full cost is $375.
Holy
shit. Is that just divisible by 5 for the per person? Because we're getting 2 freebies.
2 freebies.
Josh and I are free.
Oh, why are you guys for free?
Because we won the WIT.
Oh. So...
I'll just ask Travis.
Why is it $375 per team? That seems high.
It's including what's a registration deposit, is what it says.
Is that including like rooms or meals or anything, or just the...
Meals, yes.
Because that is... Let's see. I guess that's $75 a person, right?
Yeah.
It's $75 a person. But if you have a coach, it's only $62.50 a person.
Well, the coach doesn't have to pay because you're not playing. So you can just come for free, Scott.
So $225.
I can't believe the guy that organized the Trollisode, purports to love trolls, is all in on trolls, super excited about Madrak is switching to Crix. Just can't believe it. Just cannot believe it.
The guy who said, Scott, I have some advice for you. Play Crix, run stuff forward, is giving me a hard time.
No.
Because I decided to take his advice.
You are misquoting me, sir. I said, run stuff forward, feet, profit. Because that's how Crix works. That's how Crix works.
You're right. You're right. I'm surprised that the guy who told me, drop what you're doing, stop playing the faction you love, because because you really want to get out there and try as hard and be the biggest try hard you can. Here's my advice to you. Play Crix, push stuff forward, feet, profit, is giving me a hard time about taking his advice. When you are such a known player, you are so skilled at this game that at my level, my lowly level, I would listen to you and take your advice.
I'm actually not skilled at the game.
You're giving me grief about this.
No, I think you frankly earned it, Scott. Like, I don't know why you're surprised. I said, if you really want to win, why don't you just play Crix? And I mean, that's good advice. Keith, is that bad advice?
I mean, I don't think Crix is necessarily any better than any other.
What are you playing?
I mean, I play Crix because I love the aesthetic and the flop.
Which aesthetic would that be? Would it be the Revenant Crew aesthetic?
I heard someone in the background say win rate.
That's a really
good
aesthetic.
I'm pretty sure that has... Yeah, that's... I think the most attractive model of all is the natural curvature of the 6 and the 7 as it makes a percentage in win rate to Keith. I think that's the most appealing aesthetic of it.
Well, I mean, we are back in the, like, favored son status that Crix has sort of enjoyed all through the history of War Machine, for the most part.
They had, like, a year where they weren't.
No, I agree. It took them a year to be like, okay, everybody thinks Crix is bad now, so now we can fix it and not get in trouble. So,
well, to be fair, Crix before CID was pretty... Crix before Ghost Fleet and then CID was pretty...
it wasn't
pretty
bad.
Pretty bad.
It wasn't that it was bad. It just didn't have a 70% win rate.
All right, we are registered.
Cool. All right, well, we've been recording, Keith, so I guess we could just intro and start doing this episode. Does that sound good?
Unless we have any pre-rambly stuff. I haven't seen any new...
We could talk about Stranger... Yeah, we could talk about Stranger Things, too.
Haven't seen it yet.
Justice League.
I've read the reviews, and the reviews are hilarious.
Oh, I saw it. I thought it was fun. I think it was on par with most of the Marvel movies.
What all do you want to talk about tonight, by the way?
Well, I figured Keith and I would talk about our really, really hard journey through the team tournament at the Renegade Open.
Okay.
And then talk a little bit about we both played in a steamroller, kind of get a snapshot of the meta. As far as like an overarching topic, one thing I wanted to get Scott's feedback on is I want to either talk about list building or talk about like the lessons that you learn from games while you're playing, because I feel like there's I don't know. I have some thoughts on, and I don't know if it'll lead to any discussions or just be a couple statements by me, but I have some thoughts on like how you approach the game and how you, as a newer player, like what can you take away from a game as far as like what did you learn from it? Because I don't know, I always learn lots of little things in games. And one thing that I'm finding in Mark 3 is I don't know the catalog like I did in Mark 2. So I'm playing suboptimally in a lot of games because I don't have the catalog knowledge. So, you know, it might be a good investment of time just to read through all the cards in the game. Just pick a faction a week or whatever and just start reading through cards and sort of absorbing some of it. You won't remember all of it, but there's a lot of detail, a lot of detail there. I don't know. Do you guys have any topics you want to talk about?
How much time do we budget for ragging on Scott?
Oh, that's happening. He's switching to Crix. So also, Keith, I've decided that I'm fighting back this year, and 2018 is going to be dad joke 2018. I'm going to tell a dad joke every podcast.
I mean, that doesn't hurt me, but that's fine.
Yeah.
Currently, I was just about to close Facebook, but then I ran into what appears to be a video from, I assume, a Japanese game show, because it always is, of like five guys who appear to be covered in like Astrolube trying to climb up ice stairs made out of ice.
All dressed as Power Rangers?
Yep, yep. It's highly entertaining.
Japanese game shows are a whole different category. They had one the other day where people were on walls built out of boxes, and then you would pick a category and various bad things would happen. Like people would come out and storm your wall of boxes, and they always pick people who are scared of heights. So as the boxes came falling down, they would get closer and closer to falling.
Japanese game shows are like on another level, right? Like they just are.
Yep.
They are fun.
John, I know it's not War Machine, but did you want to touch on SteamCon?
I didn't go. I guess we could talk about God Tier, but I think Matt Hart agreed to come on the podcast to talk about God Tier at some point. So we could just hold off on that until he comes on, I think.
I knew it had just ended, so.
And I didn't make it to SteamCon this year, but I will be going to SteamCon USA, which is in 2 weeks. So that'll be cool.
Where's that at?
Chicago.
Oh, okay. SteamCon is Steamforged's big.
Yep.
That's their big show, right?
It is.
It's their lock and load. It's the con they made.
I got to get a hold of some of those guys. Dark Souls is excellent. This year at MuzonCon, I really want to, like, I have a couple ideas for, like, this big, like, meat grinder, like, Dark Souls game. I want to see if I can get some structure behind it and maybe get some love from Steamforged.
I guarantee you. When you're ready to have that discussion, I'll put you in contact with the guy that'll make that happen. So,
won't that cut into your qualifier time?
Depends on when it's scheduled and the timing and how to run it. But I think if we play it close, I could probably make that happen.
Hey, Scott, there is good news. Depends. I was going to say, there is good news with you switching to Crix. You don't have to worry about me netdecking you anymore.
Well, you'll just have a Crix drop like everybody else.
No. I netdeck Keith. So you're going to get caught in the crossfire, but at least you won't be able to say that I'm netdecking you.
Well, that's true. I mean, in a way, though, you will be netdecking me, though, because let's be perfectly fair and completely honest. I'm not going to go through and develop my lists. I'm going to look over at Keith, and I'm going to go, "Oh, great wizard of Crix, what is thy bidding, my master?" And then he will say, "Play this, it's good." And I will say, "Yes, my master." And then I will go play it. And that is exactly how that's going to work.
Oh, I want to talk about the Madrak 1 list that I built.
That list is really good.
There's Troll Dojo coming on this episode, that's for sure.
That could have been better, though. It's Scott going, "I'll play whatever Keith tells me to." And Keith goes, "I want to talk about Troll Dojo."
All right. Well.
Saved by Keith. I'm back in my faction. Woo!
I mean, I think it is, if not better, it is as good as most Crix lists are, especially particularly after CID.
It's definitely a strong, well, we'll talk about it, but it's very strong in SR 2017, which is basically how I win every game I play, because my lists are built to play in SR 2017, and a lot of lists are not. So it's a real advantage in the meta right now to have your list built to play in those scenarios.
According to Travis from an update he just gave me, there are now 24 teams registered for the ATs.
Cool. So if they get to 32, if they get past 32, it goes to six rounds, huh?
Yep.
Hmm.
A good possibly. Potential, yeah. A very possible.
That's crazy. Good luck, guys. Good luck.
We don't need luck. We so have hard. Keith.
But they also have you. So good luck, guys.
Scott, you wound me.
I wound you. Oh, that's going to be a hard, hard night. No, it's crazy, though. I have so many friends going to the APC that, like, I don't know who to root for, like, because I know my friends are going to end up paired up against each other
Scott.
At some point, and I'm just going to be standing there pulling my hair out, going, I'm so conflicted.
Scott.
Like, it's awesome.
You're 100% rooting for us. You're our coach. Otherwise, you can't be the coach, dude. I'm just telling you right now.
No, I mean, like, I get that. I just, like, you, like, it's one of those things that, like, obviously.
I think you should stop talking. So... You're going to get yourself in trouble.
Hey, first rule of digging a hole, when you get a hole, stop. I get it. No, I just want to see all my friends do really well. That's all. Like, I know there can only be one winner, but I just want to see all my friends do really well. It sucks whenever you see your friends get, like, paired up against each other and you're like, I know only one of them can win and I'm on this team. Heck, like, this is where I want to see go. Like, I have a vested interest in this, but you still don't want to see your friends get knocked out. It's like you and Keith having to play each other in the finals, which I'm sure you guys are going to talk about.
Well, I don't think there was any doubt that Keith was rooting for Keith and I was rooting for me in that game, right, Keith?
Yeah, no, definitely.
No.
there was no conflict. We had no conflict of interest at all. I don't think we understand what you're talking about, Scott, if I'm being honest.
When you get to that table at that moment, there's no, like, oh, it'll be okay if I lose because my friend will win. It's no, I hate that guy. I'm going to beat him. Maybe sometime, like, way after the fact, after, like, a week or two after you lost, you'd be like, yeah, I guess it was. But no, there's, like, the wound will last. Like, you have to – got to want it, Scott. You got to want it.
That's the first lesson, Scott. If you're going to play to win, you got to play to win.
And, Scott, from my perspective, I mean, I want Keith to win just flat out. So there was no debate.
Wait, what?
I don't understand how this was tough for Scott, okay?
Yeah, one of us has forced you into has gagged you about trolls at a time when you most wanted to talk about trolls, and the other one of us is me, who's built you great troll lists. Like, how are you conflicted?
Oh god, you're right.
Because you are an evil Sith Lord, Keith. That's how he's
one
conflicted.
One of us is nice and one of us is John Damaris.
No, I'm the exactly, nice one. Right? Hey, how many awards do you have for sportsmanship, Keith?
None.
Yeah.
None at all.
There you go. Obviously, I'm the nice one. I have an award to prove it.
Have you ever heard, Keith, have you ever heard people say that, you know, the guy who has to remind people of his accomplishments is really, really concerned about the validity of those accomplishments? Have you ever heard that?
I'm just...
Yeah. That makes
I'm just curious. I'm curious how often you have to tell people you're the nice guy.
What?
That's kind of my point.
It's only because people like to troll me and say that I'm not the nice guy, and they're just trolling me, right? But the listeners don't know the difference, so now they think I'm not the nice guy, so then I have to defend myself because I am actually the nice one.
I mean, it's the same basic gist as, I'm so humble, I'll tell you all about it.
Exactly, right?
I'm not very humble. I am very nice.
So welcome to Muse on Minis episode.
Yeah, we should probably get this one going. We can intro in.
What episode?
This is 334.